Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. A continuing sort of grab bag episode because busy times.
And busy times, yes.
Lots of stuff going on. We are going to talk about, among other things, I have played some of the EA Access trial of Mass Effect Andromeda, which I say trial, I mean they give you the game for 10 hours, so it's the game.
Right.
I played a good amount of that, and I will give some reactions to that later. They are not positive. We'll go...
Yeah, anyone who has been anywhere on the internet that talks about video games probably knows.
Here, I'll give my one-sentence summary.
Okay.
The facial animations are the least of this game's problems.
Okay, that's disconcerting based on a lot of GIFs I've seen.
Yeah. Those look like they're from a pre-Xbox 360 era. They're not the only thing in the game.
Okay.
So we'll talk about that. And let's see, we're also going to talk about The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild for our third week in a row, because in addition to me continuing to play the fucking shit out of it, you have started playing the fucking shit out of it.
Yes, you have very kindly let me borrow your Wii U, so I have been playing the Wii U version of The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, and I have no idea how many hours I put into it, but I'm a good clip into the game.
You can actually check on the Wii U, because it has an activity log.
Oh, okay.
Which is great. The Switch, it's the one thing I, like, right now I wish the Switch had, because it's like, robust internet stuff, that'll be great down the line, but there's nothing that would use it yet. I want an activity log, because the last couple Nintendo consoles have had those, and it's great to be able to check.
Yeah. But, yeah, I've been mostly staying away from the OS side of the Wii U, because it's just...
Fair enough.
It scares me, it frightens me. There's things about that console that are mysterious in so many ways.
But we'll talk about that. I mean, just quickly, I mean, we're going to get more into spoilers with Zelda this time than we have in the past. It's been 2 weeks, so I think that's fair. But y'all know I love this game to death, and I'm 3 weeks in, I love it more than ever. What are you thinking about it?
Yeah, like, I'm not quite having that experience with it yet. Like, I'm definitely liking it a lot, and I think it's a really fascinating game, but there are a lot of things that annoy me about it as well. Like, there are some nitpicks, and I think some more, like, significant issues I have with the game. That, like, sometimes I'm having a fantastic, amazing time with it. Other times I just sort of, like, leave the game really kind of frustrated and bored with it. And I've had a very up-and-down experience with it overall.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But I think it's a really fascinating game, nonetheless. Like, it's definitely, so far, it's the best Zelda game I've played since Ocarina of Time. So,
yeah.
That's something.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so I fucking love that game. I'm excited to just talk about, I can freely talk about things with the game now a little bit, because we managed to get into a lot of stuff with it in the last 2 weeks, and I think you're probably realizing now how much I wasn't getting into.
Yeah.
Even though it sounded like maybe sometimes I wasn't. So a lot of stuff to talk about there.
It is a very big video game. That is for sure.
Yeah. No, I mean the experience of just realizing for the first time, oh, that's how big the map is.
Yeah.
Like, I thought the Great Plateau might be the whole game, because it's big on its own. Yeah. So we'll talk about all of that, and that'll be fun. Let's get into just some random stuff, though.
Yes.
Do you want to just start with relaying your Wii U experiences so far?
Sure, because it's not a huge amount of stuff. But
and it's
not
tied to, like, Zelda specifically.
Yeah, not really, but it is, because I was telling you right before we started the podcast, I had a very weird experience with the audio side of the Wii U for whatever reason, where, like, one, the Wii U just doesn't have, like, an optical audio port on this back, and that is the easiest way for me to plug it into my sound system, and that's just kind of like a weird omission. And I had to, for whatever reason, though, like, even because I have my sound system just plugged into my TV, so anything pumping audio into the TV should be pumping it into the sound system, and it should be fine. For whatever reason, the Wii U was not doing that, and I just had to switch a bunch of cables and try a bunch of shit, and then eventually it was like, magically, I just had, like, this one cable, just it was like, okay, this one just works. Nothing else has had this issue. For whatever reason, I have just had to go and, like, scrounge my, like, magic cable box I have in, like, the storage room and pull out a bunch of random shit. And then so then the audio problems were mostly fixed, except for sometime into The Legend of Zelda, like, probably past, like, the first 3 to 4 cutscenes you see around the beginning that you more or less, like, I mean, you can wander off there, but are kind of funneled around this sort of story path. And there are a bunch of little cutscenes that are supposed to have voice acting, but didn't have voice acting, and I didn't know, since I hadn't played the game yet, if they were absolutely 100% supposed to have voice acting, or if, like, maybe that was more like the Zelda stuff. And so then eventually I found there are these cutscenes you can basically find that show you like what happened hundreds of years ago or 100 years ago with like you and Zelda, and you can go find these cutscenes of the world and replay them whenever you want. And it's when I found one of those that I knew for sure this is absolutely where voice acting is supposed to be. I'm absolutely convinced. And so then doing a little bit of investigation, I found out there's a weird setting in the Wii U between surround sound and stereo, which should not have had, there shouldn't have been any issue with that. And I don't know why that would cause only the voice acting sound to be missing, because I found there was no other audio missing. So by flipping that switch, it was like, okay, there, now I can get weird British Zelda. Great. Those problems are solved. Other than that, it's just weird stuff of like, I've been using the Wii U Pro Controller mostly because I like the touchpad controller is a bit hefty, to especially if you're playing Zelda for hours on end, and there's a like toggling between those two things is like weirdly awkward, and like it will like sometimes, because I have the gamepad face down on this like little like side table next to my couch, and sometimes if like I bump that table or something, all of a sudden control will go back to the Wii U gamepad and he'll go tumbling off because I have the Wii U gamepad face down. Because as far as I can determine, maybe you can correct me on this, Jonathan, there's no way to alter the brightness on that screen.
Yes, there is.
No, there is. Is there a way to just turn it off?
There's a way to turn off the screen, and okay. There's 5 brightness levels.
Okay, well, how do you do that?
I can show you later. Okay. It's in from, you can do it from either controller, but basically you go, you hit the like home button, and it does, before it takes you home, there's like all those options.
Okay.
You go into controller settings, and for the gamepad, there's a button right there that says display off, and there should be, and I think this only appears on the gamepad itself, there's 5 brightness levels.
That you can switch. That's good, because I've poked around, but I couldn't see anything. Yeah. But like the menu design of the Wii U, I just find,
it's
obtuse.
It is the biggest improvement going from like the Wii U to the Switch in a lot of ways, is not just UI stuff, but how it handles controllers. Like, I didn't get to talk about this last week, but it's one of the great things about the Switch is that it is the best system I've ever seen for handling multiple controllers. Because like, if you're maybe playing with the Joy-Cons, you're like, I'm going to switch to the Pro Controller. You grab the Pro Controller, press any button on it, and it just switches to it, and it turns the other controllers off automatically.
Oh, that's cool.
I would kill for that on some other consoles. Yeah. And it's like they were... Clearly someone at Nintendo was hypersensitive to how troublesome that was on the Wii U.
Yeah. Although thinking of controllers turning off, that's another weird thing. Maybe this is probably a setting I could go find. But right now, like, the Pro Controller turns off after what seems like 3 minutes or something.
Really weird.
Yeah, if I set it down and I, like, go upstairs to make a sandwich, I have come back downstairs and, like, it, the controller off-screen has gone. It's like, holy shit, that's just... That thing goes off super fast.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, it's just, you know, the Wii U, it's clearly an older console at this point, and it is kind of weird going back to that in, like, the whole, like, main UI system where they have, like, the two different kinds of screens, like, the carousel and then the Wii-looking, like, you know, like, grid boxes, and those, like, you can flip that between which one is displaying on the controller and which one is on the TV. Like, all that stuff is just weird, and I don't quite understand why anything on that console was quite designed the way it was. But
luckily, this game is the last time anyone will have to experience it.
Yeah. It's an interesting console. It is. Yeah.
Well, I mean, at least, you know, you get to play Zelda on it.
Yeah, yeah. Because once you load into the game, it's like,
it's whatever.
Yeah, it goes away. Yeah, yeah. So that's not any sort of wacky adventures. Nothing to the extent of, like, some of the shit you've had to deal with the Wii U. But obviously, I'm just, like, using it to play one game, so... Yeah.
I'll say, you know, the surround thing, that's not just limited to the Wii U. Surround sound is a weird thing. Like, I've had this issue lately with some DVDs. Doesn't happen to Blu-rays, but DVDs. If I put them in the PS4, something going on between the 5.1 channel on the DVD, the PS4 on my system, doesn't happen on anything else, it won't play dialogue. Huh. It's just the center channel won't play, and I have to put that in the Xbox One, and that will work, and usually things don't work better on the Xbox One. So... But it's just, it's a weird thing I've had with some DVDs. And I don't, you know, I think it's obviously not a universal issue with the PS4. Otherwise, we would hear about it more.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's just one of those, I think surround, stereo is simpler. It's 2 channels.
Yeah.
Surround has a lot of oddities to it. So, yeah, it's a weird thing.
Yeah, it is definitely, because it's just that the more things you add into that chain, mm-hmm. like, that is like, you have your TV, you have your PlayStation 4, you have, like, whatever, like, weird, like, mix or something, whatever the DVD is using, and then you also have like whatever sound system you have. There's definitely a lot of room for weird cross channels in that mix up.
All right, so we go to that. Any other stuff going on?
I have one other small bit of stuff that is completely useless to talk about, but I just want to talk about it because...
Hey, that's what we're here for.
Yeah, if we have any, like, forum with which to just, like, talk about the ridiculous purchases we make, this is one of those. I have next to me a DVD box set of what is an ungodly number of DVDs that is a full 1990s Chinese TV series adaptation of Romance of the Three Kingdoms, which has a fairly good reception online. And so mostly I wanted to just talk about this on the podcast. So this is completely useless for everyone listening to the podcast, but Jonathan, check out how fucking sick this packaging is.
It's amazing. So
it's so good.
Remind people why you're interested in Romance of the Three
Kingdoms. Yeah, so around the beginning of this year, I started reading through Romance of the Three Kingdoms because it's like an old historical Chinese novel that is sort of fictionalized telling of this historical events around the turn of the third century in China. And it's just a really sort of famous novel. It's interesting, and I've always had interest in it. It's, you know, like the Dynasty Warriors franchise is based on that. There's a lot of stuff based on that. And so I finished reading through that book about a month ago now, and it's something I've been thinking a lot about, and I've been watching some movies. Like, there's a very good John Woo movie called Red Cliff that I watched recently that's an adaptation of a scene from, or a battle scene from that novel.
At the time, that was the most expensive Chinese film ever made.
Yes, it is. It is a really good movie. You have to find the international version because it's split into two parts, and they edited basically 5 hours worth of movie into 2.5 hours worth of movie for the English release. So you have to find the international version for that movie. But anyways, when looking around for like adaptations of Romance of the Three Kingdoms, I stumbled upon that there existed this, like, as far as I can tell, like basically a full adaptation. I'm sure they like cut out and changed some things to make it easier, but it is over 80 episodes of this television show that they made in China in the 90s, and there was basically only one way to watch it, and that is this DVD box set that was released that has only one, basically one word of English on the front cover. Can you see what that word is?
English.
It is just the word English. That is how you know that there are English subtitles in this box set. There are also Japanese subtitles in this as well, if I wanted that. But
go through a couple layers there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's kind of weird because some of the characters, I actually recognize their names in Japanese better than Chinese because they're like anime characters are based on them and stuff like that. So there is actually kind of a weird incentive for me to do that in some ways. But basically, in investigating that, I saw that this DVD box set was available on Amazon through like another seller for $80, which is such an unbelievably good price that
for an import of anything.
Yeah, for anything. That was like, well, fuck it, I'm gonna get that. Like, even if I never ended up watching these, like, it's such a cool item and I'm gonna watch them. Like, I checked out, like, sort of like flip through the first episode because I haven't committed to like sitting down and watching the series yet. But it is cool to just see, like, okay, this is like how they, like, what these characters look like in for them and stuff like that. And it's just, it's a really, really cool thing. I'm excited to watch it. It's got some of the coolest packaging I've ever seen, that they basically have like these paper slips that all the DVDs are in that have like reprints of traditional Chinese art that depict different scenes from the book.
It looks like you're flipping through a book of art.
Yeah.
But the DVDs are in there. It's some of the best TV show packaging I've ever seen.
Yeah. And then they have all the chapters that are covered in each of the DVDs written on there as well. With, as far as I can determine, what are the, like, each chapter in Romance of the Three Kingdoms, like, begins with this thing that says, like, And Cao Cao invades the south, and Liu Bei and Guan Yu meet upon the hill, and like a, like 3 to 4 sentences of sort of like what happens in this chapter, and I'm pretty sure that is on all the DVD slip covers. They say like that's what this is, and it's the same text. So yeah, it's really cool. I'm excited to watch it.
That's awesome. I see you had these sitting here, and I thought when I came in that was like some manga you'd gotten from Japan, maybe.
No,
and it's a book of DVDs from China.
Yes,
there we go.
So, Romance of the Three Kingdoms, I'm continuing my long, dark journey in 3rd century China.
Maybe I should just take, because I read some of it, I should take Journey to the West and get into that, and we can just take this from two angles.
Exactly. We'll cover all, like, the great historical Chinese novels. That will be the new avenue of our podcast.
Yeah.
You know, it was Doctor Who, then it was Persona, then it was Digimon. Now it is ancient Chinese historical novels.
And that's when we really lose all of our listeners.
Exactly.
Yeah. But we gain some nerd somewhere.
Maybe. Somewhere, yeah. I mean, there is a whole like group of like a type of otaku in Japan that like are just obsessed with Romance of the Three Kingdoms. So I have a home there now I can go to if I need to.
Nice. So I have a couple of stuff things.
Okay.
Some movie stuff.
Yes.
I haven't talked about movie stuff in a while. A couple weeks ago we had Logan. That was fun.
You talked about King Kong.
I did talk about King Kong. I forgot about that.
Yeah, I still haven't seen that lately. Yet.
Some good movies. I saw another good movie this weekend, and so did everyone else in America, apparently. I went to see Beauty and the Beast.
The live action
yes. Disney remake of Beauty and the Beast. And it's fair to call this a remake. This is not like we're being cutesy. This is a redoing of the original fairy tale. This is a remake of the animated movie.
Okay.
Although it adds enough new stuff that I think it's worth it. Really good movie. I actually really liked it. I'll talk about that in a second. I want to talk about the overwhelming popularity of this movie for a moment because it was kind of funny. I have not had an experience having trouble getting into a movie in a long time.
Huh.
I had trouble getting in to see Beauty and the Beast because it was so overwhelmingly popular. If you didn't see the numbers for the weekend, it broke 170 million for the weekend, which Damn. Is the March opening weekend record. Thank God that doesn't belong to Batman v Superman anymore.
Oh, yeah, anyway. That's... Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good.
Beauty and the Beast... It's better. In any form, it is better than Batman v Superman.
I mean, that doesn't take much, but you are definitely right.
Anyway, so obviously made a lot of money. Now, on the ground, I went to see this Friday night with my brother who's in town. And we got to our favorite theater, which is the Harkins here in Denver. It's got this big screen called the Cine Capri. It's the biggest screen in Colorado. It's just the nicest auditorium. That auditorium also has 600 seats. It's by far the biggest theater I've ever seen, movie theater I've ever seen. And one of the benefits of that is that you can usually get there and there will be tickets at the door, even if it's a popular movie, because you got 600 people is a lot to go to one auditorium. You usually don't have anywhere near that in a movie theater. And anyway, we got there a half hour early and we went to the ticket counter and it was already sold out. So, and like the theater was full, 600 people had come to see Beauty and the Beast on that screen.
Jesus.
And they had it playing on like four or five other screens that night. So I said, okay, well, what's the next showtime? She said, well, we were going to 7:30 showtime. She said, 7:45 or something, it's playing, but that's 90% full already, and so you probably won't be able to sit together. And I'm like, well, okay, not doing that. What's the next showtime? It's like, it's at 8:15, and it's only 50% full. And I'm like, okay, we'll do that, and this is already getting insane. And it's like, it's not that I was like super devoted to going to see this movie, it's just that we made the drive, we were there, it's like, might as well just go see the movie. So anyway, wait until 8:15, go see the movie. By the time the movie starts, the theater is 100% full. So I mean, there were literally thousands of people at this one theater there going to see Beauty and the Beast.
My God.
It was insane. And luckily, the movie was really good.
Nice.
Better than I was expecting. And I keep saying that, actually, about Disney's live-action remakes of their animated movies, because this is one of those things that, on paper, all of these movies should be bad and annoying.
Yeah.
They really should, because the early ones were. Like, Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland is a pile of goat shit. It's horrible. And if you go back further, you know, there's no one doing a movie club rewatch of, like, Glenn Close's 101 Dalmatians. Which is like...
I didn't even know they... Oh,
that's
shit,
from like the
did.
90s, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Like, I've all of a sudden, a like VHS cover of that movie has like floated into my head.
And it's real, I'm not making this up, sequel, 102 Dalmatians, which was a thing.
Yeah.
I think I saw that when I was a kid. I remembered literally nothing about it. But anyway. Yeah, so this is like their new initiative, though. And it's produced some pretty good movies. Like, you know, The Jungle Book I talked about last year, which I thought was a really cool reimagining of that story. And I think Beauty and the Beast is even better than that. I think it's a very solid movie. It's a very enjoyable movie. It is definitely a remake of the animated film, which on its own is like this kind of incredible act of hubris for Disney.
Right.
Because that's probably their most beloved animated movie. Mm-hmm. It's that or like Snow White or something, you know, if I'm trying to think of like what are the movies of theirs that have the most cultural penetration, it's got to be Beauty and the Beast or Snow White, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's kind of a big thing to say, we're just going to straight up remake that, do the same songs, same kind of characterization. But it works. I think it works because it's a very creative movie. I think it's a very well-made movie, extremely well-acted, and it seems like everyone involved has a lot of fun. I don't know if the film as a whole sort of rises above to be like its completely own thing, and I don't know if it ever could, but it's a really fun riff on the material. So, you know, you've got, like, just the way they do some of the stage, some of the songs. Like, the best scene in the entire movie is the Gaston musical number,
okay.
Which is one of the best scenes in the animated movie,
yes.
Too. And Gaston is such a great character. And how they do that here, for one, the actors. Gaston is played by Luke Evans, who I love so much. He was Bard the Bowman in the Hobbit
right,
movies.
Yeah.
He was the villain in Fast and Furious 6. And he's a really good actor. He's probably a really underrated actor, I think, too, because he's been in a lot of stuff, and I don't think he gets the praise he quite deserves. And he's just the perfect choice for Gaston, and he just chews into that material so hard. And then he's accompanied by Josh Gad playing LeFou, who I didn't know that was actually the name of the character, but it's like the little fat guy who follows Gaston around. And they've kind of reimagined that relationship. And it's led to some stupid controversy in the media, where LeFou is presented basically as he's a closeted gay man.
Okay.
And he's clearly in love with Gaston. And
I mean, who isn't? It's Gaston.
Exactly. And so he's like following Gaston around and doing everything for him because he wants Gaston to notice him and to like him. And so the way they do the Gaston musical number is, in the animated movie, that scene is literally just everyone in the pub loves Gaston and they're singing about him.
Yeah.
Here it's, Gaston is just one guy in the town. And he probably has an inflated sense of self. And LeFou wants to make him cheer up because Belle said she didn't want to marry him. So LeFou basically is going around the bar, kind of behind the scenes enticing everyone to start singing about Gaston. And like the flow of that musical number, which has been kind of expanded into this big 6-minute thing, is so fucking funny and like well done. And is it actually like an interesting character progression for both LeFou and Gaston in how like they kind of build up and up and up this thing until everyone really is singing along and having fun with it. And there's just scenes like that where it's like, that is, you know, it's the scene from the animated movie, it's the song, but it's being reimagined in a way that I find very entertaining. And a lot of the other scenes in this are sort of the same way. I think the director, Bill Condon, who is, I don't think he's the greatest director in the world, but he's a talented guy, and I think he helmed this with a, you know, there's a lot of creativity to it. The Be Our Guest song is another one they have a lot of fun with, even though that's probably one of the harder ones to do because it's this, in the animated movie, obviously it's all the, like, houseware from the Beast's Mansion and everything coming to life. So, of course, in this, it also has to be primarily animated in different ways. But I think they find ways to make it different. And part of that is that all the actors playing the houseware have so much fun with it. And they're such different interpretations of those characters. So, like, Lumiere, the candelabra, is played by Ewan McGregor. Doing a delightful French accent.
Okay.
And he has the most fun of anyone in this movie. Like, Ewan McGregor clearly came into, like, the voice recording booth and was just really happy. And had a lot of fun with it. And that comes across so much. And it's such a great little performance by Ewan McGregor. And then Cogsworth, the clock, is played by Ian McKellen.
Okay.
And it is a great character. Because in the animated movie, it seems like Lumiere and Cogsworth are like just friends and everything. In this, like Lumiere is the young Frenchman and Cogsworth is this really old butler dude. And they have a lot of fun with that. And Ian McKellen, who I would not expect to be as game as he is for this, to voice the animated clock, but he is. He has a lot of fun with it, and he's really, really good. There's some other good performances. I think Emma Thompson is playing Mrs. Potts, which is the Angela Lansbury part from the original, and that's one of the hardest, I think, to kind of overcome the iconography of that, but it's Emma Thompson, and she's really good at what she does.
Yes.
So, a lot of good actors there. The actors for the main characters, we've got Emma Watson as Belle. She's really good in this. She's really good. I mean, I love Emma Watson in just about everything. She's clearly a really talented actress.
Yeah.
But she can sing, and that's great. She's good for the part. I think they've done as effective a job as you probably can do within the Disney framework of modernizing Belle and the Beauty and the Beast story. And that is to say, you cannot fully modernize that, because it is, at the end of the day, a story about a girl who gets kidnapped and falls in love with a beast. But within that framework and the kind of Disneyfication of it, which is you're never going to go like full Jean Cocteau postmodern with it and make fun of it.
Right.
This is not an ironic version of the story. This is a sincere version. They've done a good job of giving Belle more agency than she probably has in other tellings of this story, including the animated film. And her relationship with the Beast there's more sort of intellectual evenness between them because they've reimagined certain things about the Beast character, and it's a fun relationship, and I think those actors have good chemistry. The guy who plays the Beast is a guy named Dan Stevens, who I've never seen Downton Abbey, but I guess he's one of the main characters on that, and he definitely has a wonderful British accent, so that's great.
I love that they have apparently plumbed like the British acting community for this movie set in France.
They have, yeah.
It's kind of weird when you think about it.
Yeah. That's how we do Europe, is they're just British.
They're all just British, aren't they?
Yeah, everyone in Europe is British. And it's kind of funny because this movie, actually, some of its story expansions, it is much more, like, the animated movie and most versions of Beauty and the Beast are set in France, quote-unquote, but it's a fairy tale France. It doesn't really matter it's set, right? This is set in France. Like, there's references to Paris, there's references to the time period. You leave the theater knowing, like, boy, now that Belle is married to a prince, she's going to get killed in the French Revolution in about 10 years. So that's kind of sad. But let's not think about that. But anyway.
That reminds me that, speaking of, like, weird British-accented French people, remember how Assassin's Creed Unity had all the French people have British accents?
Yeah.
The video game literally set in the French Revolution.
Yeah. That's no, weird. It mostly doesn't bother me with this because, it's just...
It's fine, but it is just sort of weird when you think about, like, what that maybe says about our culture.
Yeah. And again, it's inconsistent because it's like, Emma Watson is very British. Dan Stevens is very British. Kevin Kline, who plays the father in this, Maurice, is not.
Right.
And so that's fine. Luke Evans is not. You know, it's like just different.
Wait, so does Emma Watson not put on like a ridiculous French accent?
No.
Oh.
No, it's just posh Emma Watson.
Okay.
Yeah. But no, anyway, I was saying Dan Stevens very good. He and Emma Watson have a good deal of chemistry here. My one complaint about the movie, there's little stuff, but who cares? Big complaint is I wish the Beast wasn't CGI. And I know that's never going to happen in the year 2017 in Hollywood because they love to burn money way too much. And a lot of the other CGI in the movie is good. I actually think the way they realize the household objects and don't make them utterly terrifying is really, it's actually very creative. It's kind of like before I saw The Jungle Book, the Jon Favreau movie, I thought, how do you do photorealistic animals and have them talk and not make it weird? And they found a way to do it. They do that with the household objects here, too. With the Beast, it's fine CGI. It's good. It's clearly mo-capped, and it's generally expressive. But it's just the animation's a little stiff. Like, there's stuff where, like, the center of his face will move like a face, but then, like, the horns in the surrounding area are a little too, like, still and just kind of... There's just too much... It's a little stiff, the animation. Right. And I just, especially because, of course, there's a famous Beauty and the Beast movie, the Jean Cocteau film from 1947, which has a wonderful suit for the Beast. I just wish it was a dude in a costume.
Or, like, you could do makeup, costume, or makeup. Like there's so many, like, practical ways you could make a cool-looking Beast. It is sort of disappointing.
Yeah, and I just thought the CGI was... Some of it, I also think the design of the Beast is... I think they tried to kind of straddle the line between him being a Beast and him being handsome too much. Not to the degree where, like, they made it ridiculous, where, like, he's got his shirt off and, you know, he's, like, constantly, like, you know, pouring water over himself like he's a character from Twilight or something. Not doing any of that. It's just, like...
It's just sort of like that Phantom of the Opera thing of where you need to have this character be physically attractive in some way, but the whole point of the character is that they are not supposed to be physically attractive. It's just like, well... Fuck it, marketing.
It's something I always liked about the animated movie an awful lot, is that Beast is a beast. Like, he's a lion or something. He's not... I think they make him look like a human too much, also. And the problem when you do that in CGI is then you get into Uncanny Valley stuff, and it gets a little too stiff. So, that's just a little, you know... Again, that's never going to happen in modern Hollywood, sadly, until it crashes and they need to save money. And they realize, oh, shit, we could save, like, $50 million by doing this as a suit. And it would be better. Put two and two together. And of course, it's Disney. They have the money to burn right now. But yeah, anyway. So a little complaint there. But, you know, generally I like the cast. I like the musical numbers. I liked the production design and everything. This movie was very expensive and looks every penny of it up there on screen. Yeah, there are little things here and there. I think the editing is not super great throughout the movie, especially the first scene, the like opening musical number, the Belle song that everyone knows, is way too stagey. For one, like it looks like a stage number. Yeah. And then it's also very poorly edited, and there's some weird decisions there. I think that evens out as the movie goes along, and I noticed it less and less, and I think other scenes are done better than that. But, you know, I think it's good. I think it's got some interesting extensions to the story. I think if you kind of know the animated movie, it's fun to kind of look at all the different points where they expanded or changed things and had fun with the material. They added some songs into it, and they're okay. The problem is that, I mean, that is definitely the best music ever in a Disney musical, is Beauty and the Beast, and it's largely because of Howard Ashman, the lyricist who died late in production of the film from AIDS, and, you know, Frey say he was, like, in his early 40s, and it's just a tragedy. He's not in the world, but also that we didn't get more music from him for Disney movies, and it's the Beauty and the Beast music is so distinctive that I think when you have, it's still Alan Menken doing the score, but when you have anyone else do the lyrics or kind of take the general approach to it, it just sticks out like a sore thumb a little bit.
Right.
And I don't think there's any way to avoid that, and I think some of the songs they insert are good, and like the Beast gets a solo in this that I think is probably, he doesn't actually, I think, get one at all in the animated movie, so there's just things like that I think are nice additions, but overall those are just moments that will take you out of the movie a little bit, even if you don't know who like Howard Ashman was. It's just the authorship of it. You can tell that's clearly a different songwriter. doing this one than Be Our Guest or something. But it's a good movie. Like, you know, if Disney is going to keep doing their remakes of animated movies because they know they will make an unholy amount of money, at least they're pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, they could be a hell of a lot worse, and I've generally liked these a lot lately. To the degree where the one I've missed lately, I think, is the Kenneth Branagh Cinderella movie. And I kind of want to go back
and... I don't even remember that happened.
Yeah, that happened like 2 years ago.
Huh.
And I kind of want to go back and check that out, not because like I'm a huge Cinderella fan. I like Kenneth Branagh's movies.
Yeah.
That's got Cate Blanchett as the evil stepmother.
Okay.
It's probably pretty good.
Yeah. That's good casting,
for sure. That's good casting. I think, yeah, there's some other interesting casting in it. So, you know, I'm kind of interested in what Disney's doing here. And I think part of it is they're just giving the people making these movies license to have fun with it and do different things with the material. Even in the you know, general structure of something like Beauty and the Beast, that they clearly couldn't stray too far because they were remaking the animated movie. Whereas, like, Jungle Book is kind of a remake of that animated movie, but it's largely a different story and story progression and things like that. But I liked this. And if you are somehow one of the people who did not get out in the first weekend but wanted to see this, go see it. I'm not sure that Venn diagram exists.
Yeah.
Given the money it made, but we'll see.
Yeah, like, given that this came out this year, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is going to come out this year, and the next Star Wars Episode 8 is coming out this year, how much money do you think Disney's going to make in movies this year?
My brother and I had this discussion, because I was looking at the box office list for 2016, so last year, and Disney had the top 5 on the top 10 worldwide.
Fuck.
And 4 of those top 5 made $1 billion or plus. And the one that didn't was The Jungle Book, and it only made $996 million or something.
Oh, that's just a pittance.
So that was last year. This year they're going to have Beauty and the Beast, which is clearly going to clear $1 billion. They'll have Star Wars, which will clear $1 billion. They'll have Guardians, which I think will clear $1 billion. They'll have Thor Ragnarok, which probably won't, but it'll be a big grosser.
Yeah.
And
Spider-Man.
Spider-Man is not... That's Sony's making the money for that.
Oh, okay,
the deal.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Disney will reap a lot of the hype from it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so they've got all of that, and they've also got 2 Pixar movies coming out this year, Cars 3 and the original Pixar movie Coco, which I saw a trailer for, looks amazing. I'm excited for that. That's Lee Unkrich, who directed Toy Story 3 and has been with Pixar from the beginning, and he gets to make an original movie, and it looks really cool. So that's 6, by my count, that will at least be hits, like big, sizable hits. And, yeah, I mean, for the foreseeable future, no one's going to compete with Disney because they just have it all. And the nice thing is most of these movies we're talking about are good. Like, it's hard to be jealous of their success or anything or mad about it because those are all good movies I'm naming, generally.
Yeah.
Cars 3, we'll see. But, you know.
It had a really funny, like, announcement teaser.
Yes.
For sure.
And the posters still, like, at the theater are Lightning McQueen dying in flames for some reason, because that's what the kids want.
You know, it's like what they did with Harry Potter. You know, as the kids get older, the series is growing up with them, and it needs to get dark and mature.
Cars 2 would throw the wrench in that theory, but sure.
You know, we all have our Chamber of Secrets.
All right. Yeah, so that's Beauty and the Beast. Good movie. I liked it.
Cool.
Good night at the movies.
Hold on. Before we move on, what is the next up live-action Disney movie that they're doing?
They've got so many down the pipeline, I honestly don't know off the top of my head.
Because it's like, how long is it going to take them until they have just redone all of their classic animated catalog in live-action?
They're pretty much all in development. Now, development does not mean they will make them. I think they're exploring as many of them as they can, which clearly, given the money, they should be, just from a business level. I know one of the ones further along is there's a Dumbo remake they're planning that Tim Burton is going to direct.
Oh, okay.
And that sounds like a horrible match, but we'll
see. Who does Johnny Depp play in Dumbo? Is he like the weird pink elephants that he sees when Dumbo's drunk?
Okay,
like,
that'd be funny.
Yeah.
That would be a good use of Mr. Johnny Depp. The other movie Disney has this year is Pirates of the Caribbean 5.
I saw a trailer for that in front of Logan, I think.
And it's one of those trailers that you forget it as you watch it.
Yeah. It's one of those trailers where you're like, is this a trailer for Pirates of the Caribbean 5? Or are they like re-releasing these movies on Blu-ray or something?
But now they've added Javier Bardem.
Yeah. I mean, Javier Bardem could have been in those movies and I would have forgotten it at some point.
Yes. No. I mean, fucking Pirates 4 had Ian McShane playing Blackbeard and they wasted that. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
I can't believe they're still making those movies. Pirates of the Caribbean seems like it's such an old franchise to me at this point.
Yeah. I know they had Aladdin in development, but they canceled that when Robin Williams died because I think the idea was he was going to be in it again as the genie. And I think, rightly, they don't want to do it without him. I don't know off the top of my head the other ones. Like, I don't think they've yet decided to do Snow White, but that would frankly be one of the easier ones to do.
Yeah.
Because that works in live action. I think the problem is other people have been making Snow White movies, like Snow White and the Huntsman and stuff. And so yeah, anyway, we'll see. Disney's they're gonna do more.
it just seems like it's weird to me that it's just they have these three arms of movie development, and I feel like you forget that all three of them are Disney. They have Marvel, Star Wars, and then their own original Disney. Well, not original Disney properties, but you know what I mean with like the fairy tale stuff. And it's just like,
and their own animated movies and right, Pixar. Yes.
And Pixar.
There's like five branches.
There's about like five branches of movies that they put out, and they have like one, two, or three maybe movies for each of those branches come out each year. And it's kind of terrifying to me at this point.
Yeah.
It's sort of like you see like Donald Trump becoming president, and you see like Disney doing what Disney does, and you're like, at some point Disney is going to like own our prison system or something. Like they're going to have that much money, or they're going to like own law enforcement, and we're going to be like in the RoboCop world, but all the RoboCops will have like Mickey Mouse voices or something.
So are all the guards at the Disney private prisons like animatronics from Disneyland?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And it just, they don't have any guns or anything. The prisoners just stay in their cells out of sheer terror.
Yeah, no.
Because animatronic Abraham Lincoln is scary.
But like, seriously, though, the amount of money that Disney must be amassing is so horrifying.
It's pretty crazy. Because especially you consider the billion-dollar grosses for the movies, that's one thing. The merchandising.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, it's everything on top of that. Like, it's now we have, like, all these Star Wars games coming out now. This new wave of Star Wars games, this new wave of Marvel games that's going to start coming out. That surely they're going to
start with those as well. The Cars movies are not Pixar's biggest grocers and never have been. But if I remember correctly, what I heard about the first Cars, what made them do a Cars 2, is that Cars 1, just from merchandising, toy sales and DVDs and stuff alone, profited over like $2 billion.
Man, to get that Transformers money. You make a movie or a TV show that's just entirely based on selling kids toys, you're going to rake in the bucks, man.
I saw a trailer for Transformers the last night. That was surprisingly not terrible.
Oh, okay.
Like, it was okay. Like, I was like, if I didn't know about the other four movies, I'd be like, that looks interesting.
How is there the same number of Transformers movies in Pirates of the Caribbean movies? How is this, like, this world we live in?
I mean, at least, you know, say what you will about the Transformers movies, they still are very successful. The last Pirates movie in the U.S. basically flopped. Outside of the U.S., it made over $1 billion, so that's why they're making a fifth, but it's, although Transformers 4 did the same thing, so never mind. Who knows? It's, you know, they make a lot of money, and Michael Bay's gotta plate his house in gold.
It's weird.
So he too can run for president one day.
Movies are weird. The world we live in is strange.
You know, I think Michael Bay would, frankly, be more qualified than Donald Trump because he spent more time with the American military.
This is a very good point.
He has more respect for them. He would probably be more cautious in, like, authorizing action.
Like, just imagine how fucking dope all the, like, military, like, enlistment commercials in front of movies would be if Michael Bay was president. Like, that would be, you know, all the time that Donald Trump is spending in, like, golf courses and stuff. That would be, like, Michael Bay's version of that, is he's just off in, like, Afghanistan shooting his next fucking commercial
for the Michael US military. Bay would be traveling from military camp to military camp masturbating at everything he saw.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, frankly, would be a better use of his time than tweeting. So, you know.
That's the wild and wacky world we live in.
All right. I want to do one other piece of stuff before we move on.
Okay.
This was an interesting thing that was going around the internet this week, was people doing this trend on Twitter where they were listing their favorite films from every year they've been alive.
Okay.
And I did this, and I tweeted this out, and I had fun with this project.
Okay.
So I want to go through some of this list.
Okay.
Because I did this from, like, so I was born in 1992 to now.
Yes.
And it was really an interesting project because, obviously, some of these years I was alive but not really watching movies, so it was fun to look back on what movies I've discovered since I was a kid that I would put on here, and also just taking the scope of, like, the three decades I've been alive and when movies were the best. And if I actually, looking at this list, and I'm saying, like, of the years that were easier to choose, harder to choose, all that stuff, the 2000s were hot shit for movies a lot of the time. There are a couple of standout years there, like 07 and 01 are fantastic. 08's okay, 09's okay. But then there's like 2002, where literally the only movie I think I liked that year was The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers.
Okay.
So that's the one I put there. Or 2004, where There was almost nothing other than the Bourne Supremacy, which I didn't put on there because there was one other movie I liked more, which was Howl's Moving Castle.
Okay, yeah.
Of course, then you get into hard territory where that's the year of release in Japan. I didn't actually see it in 2004, but whatever. I'm going to go by original release year. So anyway, it was fun. So like, I'll go through some of these and just point out some of these years that were hilariously bad and others that were hilariously like overwhelming.
Right.
So like 1992, my year of birth, I had the Hayao Miyazaki movie Porco Rosso.
Okay, yeah.
1992 is a pretty good year for film. It's early in the indie explosion of the 90s that led to a lot of the big directors of the 2000s. So that's also the year of like Reservoir Dogs and stuff.
Okay,
Tarantino's first movie. Not my favorite film from that year.
Porco Rosso over Reservoir Dogs is the right choice.
Well, yeah. I mean, Porco Rosso is one of my favorite movies ever made. 1993, I got to have one Takeshi Kitano on here, which is Sonatine.
Yes, okay.
So it's Japan. So far, you'll see the trend of, I think, foreign films were better in the 90s than American films. But yeah.
As someone who's a child in the 90s, I do think that kind of checks out.
Yeah. Kitano's Sonatine, one of his great. Not my favorite Kitano movie, but my favorite Kitano movie came out in a busier year. So anyway, Sonatine's here. 94, I could have been cute and put on Wong Kar-wai's Chungking Express, which is one of my favorite movies, but I put Pulp Fiction because it's kind of hard not to Pulp Fiction.
Sure, yeah.
Someone will say, what about The Shawshank Redemption? And I'm going to tell you, I think that movie's overrated. 95, I put Toy Story.
It's
the only Pixar movie I was able to fit on here. Also, like, there I could have been cute and there are other movies in 95, but also just in terms of historical importance... Toy Story. It's kind of hard to say. No, Toy Story is the most important movie from that year for a wide variety of reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. 96, I had Bottle Rocket by Wes Anderson. That's his first movie. Yeah. Not my favorite Wes Anderson, and there were other movies in 96 that are interesting, but that is a great movie and also very representative of, again, this time. The 90s are the story of, one, great foreign imports into the U.S., and two, these great indie directors who become big forces in the 2000s. 97 is Princess Mononoke, Hayao Miyazaki.
Okay, yeah.
And 97 has a bunch of other great movies. The other one here would be Takeshi Kitano's Hanabi, which is, both of those movies are probably in my personal top 10 all time.
Yeah.
And they're both from 97, so Japan had a good year. Anyway.
Those are also two very different movies.
Two extremely different movies.
Yeah.
They are both very violent, although Princess Mononoke is animated violence, which is a little different.
Yeah, no, this is,
1998 is Terrence Malick's The Thin Red Line, which, one of the best movies on this list. It's great. That's a great movie. Best war movie ever made, in my opinion. 1999 is The Matrix. 1999 is a great year for film. One of the best years of the 90s. And there's a lot I could have picked here. To me, it's The Matrix. Just for a wide variety of reasons, I think it's also one of the most important movies of that decade. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, 2000 is Battle Royale by Kenji Fukasaku. Going back to Japan for that.
Yeah, more Takeshi Kitano. A slightly different capacity, but he's still there.
Wonderful capacity. I still think that's his best performance on film. He's fantastic in that. Battle Royale, it's just one of my favorite movies, and also I think a movie with such an amazing story in that it was not legally available in the United States until 2011, and yet it is one of the most influential films of that decade. And that's amazing. That it did not get outside of Japan legally, and yet it had this huge influence that we're still feeling. Just look at the number of movies that use Dies Irae, the specific recording from Battle Royale, things like that. 2001, which is probably the best year on this list because there's a lot of movies I wanted to pick here, but ultimately for me it's Spirited Away, which is my other favorite Hayao Miyazaki movie. Could have gone with Mulholland Drive, could have gone with Fellowship of the Ring.
Yeah.
2001 is a crazy good year for films.
Could have gone with 2001 A Space Odyssey.
different kind of 2001, but yeah. And 2001, all these great movies, has the distinction of what I think is the worst movie to ever win Best Picture, A Beautiful Mind.
Okay,
with Russell Crowe,
that did win Best Picture.
At least in my lifetime, that is the worst movie to win Best Picture.
Yeah.
I will say, I think unequivocally. Anyway.
I saw that movie in like... psychology class in high school, I think.
We watched that together because we were in the same class.
Right, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a bad... I had seen it before, but that's a bad
movie. That is definitely like... That is the scenario in which you see that movie, I feel like. There's no other world in which someone who didn't see that movie, like, when it came out that year, would see that movie other than in, like, a weird psychology class.
I think when it comes out on, like, Blu-ray now, like, in its, like, re-releases and stuff, it says at the top, like, 2001 Academy Award for Best Picture, and then right under that, ... We know.
Yeah.
We're sorry. Yeah. Anyway, 2002 is Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, because...
That's
best picture winner that year is Chicago, which I like with serious reservations because it's a I don't know. It's half poorly directed and half not, but it's got great performances. Anyway, it's not nowhere near Two Towers. So Two Towers and 2003 is Return of the King.
Okay, yeah.
2003, I could have been cute and put Master and Commander, which is another one of my favorite movies. But still, to me, Return of the King is
just.
2004 is Howl's Moving Castle. 2005 was The New World by Terrence Malick. So you're starting to see all my repeating directors on here. But this is where I just get to be honest, and it's great. 2006. Nothing other than like The Departed, which is a really good movie, but not my favorite Scorsese. And ultimately, here I went with Casino Royale, which is, I still think, the best James Bond movie.
Yeah.
And so like, there is probably, I could have looked further for like a foreign film or something here, but I really like Casino Royale, so I'm fine putting it there.
It's a good movie.
It's a good movie. 2007 is the other, like, one of the great years here, because you have No Country for Old Men, you have There Will Be Blood, you have a bunch of other great films. I still go with The Darjeeling Limited, which is my favorite Wes Anderson movie, and is probably one of my 10 favorite films ever, and I love it to death. Even if I could, you know, academically speaking, I think No Country for Old Men and There Will Be Blood are somewhat better, more important movies. This is my favorite films list, so that's what I put there. 2008, The Dark Knight.
Duh. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, like, you could be cute and go with WALL-E, but Dark Knight is the movie from this year. Yeah. The movie's so good that it literally has changed the Oscar rules completely since then, because it didn't get any nominations. And that's why they've done all the weird stuff they've done with the multiple best pictures and stuff.
Right.
Which has not led to any movies like The Dark Knight ever getting nominated.
But of course whatever. Not, but you know.
So, anyway, 2009's an underratedly good year. There's a lot of good stuff here. You got Inglourious Basterds. You've got The Hurt Locker.
Right.
Things like that. I went with Fantastic Mr. Fox by Wes Anderson.
Okay.
That's the last Wes Anderson on this list, I promise. But Fantastic Mr. Fox is one of the best animated movies of its decade, and just one of the best stop-motion animated movies ever made. Wes Anderson's next film he's working on is called Isle of Dogs, and it's also stop-motion, and I can't wait. And also, if you look at his career arc, Fantastic Mr. Fox is clearly this turning point where his live-action movies since then look more like Fantastic Mr. Fox than they do his previous live-action movies, which is a fascinating thing, but if you've seen them, you know what I mean. So I love that movie. 2010 is Black Swan by Darren Aronofsky.
Okay.
It's a great, great movie. It's awesome. It's weird. I still remember I got my cousin and my brother to accompany me to that, and they still hate me for it because it's not their kind of movie.
Right, yeah.
I love it. Anyway, 2011 is The Tree of Life by Terrence Malick. Still the best movie of this decade, I would say, unequivocally. 2012 is The Grey by Joe Carnahan, which is the best use of Liam Neeson, if you have not seen it, and just a phenomenal meditation on masculinity, life, and death.
And wolves.
And wolves, and is extremely underrated and needs to be seen by more people. 2013 is Her by Spike Jones. 2014 is Inherent Vice by Paul Thomas Anderson, part of the great 1-2-3 punch of Joaquin Phoenix, where it's not my top film of 2012, but 2012 was The Master by Paul Thomas Anderson, and then we had Her, and then we had Inherent Vice, and so he was in one of the best movies of every single one of those years, and love Joaquin Phoenix. 2015 is Mad Max Fury Road.
Yes.
Duh. And 2016 is Silence by Martin Scorsese. And then other people were listing 2017 already with like a so far.
Yeah.
So I was like, it's kind of stupid, but John Wick Chapter 2. I haven't seen a better movie than John Wick Chapter 2 yet, so I'm putting it there.
Yeah, like it's John Wick Chapter 2 or Logan are literally the two movies I've seen that have come out this year. Yeah. So.
And there's other good ones. I have not gone to the theater yet and hated a movie in 2017, which is nice. But John Wick Chapter 2 is a cut above the rest.
Yeah, I think I would probably put John Wick above Logan also, though.
Because I love Logan.
They're both really good.
But, I don't know, like, it's a tough one, definitely.
Yeah, they're good for different reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
John Wick Chapter 2, part of it is just, like, Logan relies, not entirely, but so much of that is, like, our love for Hugh Jackman in that part, and it's capping off 17 years. John Wick Chapter 2 just... There is another John Wick movie, but it just comes in and knocks your fucking socks off.
Yeah.
It doesn't need 17 years of build-up.
I have definitely like had the urge to watch John Wick 2 again a lot more than I did Logan.
Yeah. Partially because Logan makes you sad.
Yes, it's hard to jump out of that movie and be like, I want to watch that again, but also fucking John Wick 2 is really good.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, I just thought that was a fun activity because it's interesting to kind of look over the years and be like, these are kind of the peaks and valleys of film in my life, and you get to see some of the trends. Like, as I said, I actually think the current decade we're in has been a really good decade for film, if you look at some of the big films there. The 2000s are a weaker decade for film than I remembered, in terms of there are pockets of greatness and then just years with nothing. And the 90s are fascinating for art house and foreign film, and the 90s are by far the worst decade for Hollywood.
Yeah, like the mainstream Hollywood movies of the 90s are just...
atrocious.
Really bad.
To the point where I think when people complain about Hollywood to this day, they're complaining about the 90s because they haven't gotten over it. And I understand. Luckily, I didn't live through the 90s that cognizantly, so I can kind of just be my own person with it. But I totally understand if you were an adult in the 90s and you saw like Deep Impact and Armageddon in the same year and you wanted to slit your wrists and never go to a Cineplex again. I understand how those
It is really like, it's when you go back and you watch those movies and you're like, wow, yeah, I get it. Independence Day was supposed to be like this big deal movie, huh? And it's like, fucking fuck that movie. That movie's not good. It's like, man. Yeah.
All right. We're going to talk about Mass Effect in a second, and then we're going to do Zelda.
Okay.
One last thing of stuff for me is I want to talk about the Nintendo Switch just a little more. Like, week three thoughts. Still loving my Switch. Nothing, not too much new to say about it. I wanted a quick follow-up on the Pro Controller, which I mentioned last week, which I love. Okay. And actually, because this weekend I was switching a lot between the Pro Controller for Zelda and my Xbox One controller for Mass Effect.
Yes.
I like the Switch Pro Controller so much more than the Xbox One controller. They have kind of similar form factors, but I just, as soon as I picked up the Xbox One controller again, I'm like, this feels uncomfortable and clunky. Like, Nintendo's, their design for that Pro Controller is very refined. I should bring it here sometime so you can try it out, just because it's a really solid controller. Anyway, what I want to say is I will, as of tomorrow, have had this thing for 2 weeks. I have played a lot of Zelda. You've played the game, so you know how you can lose hours to that game.
Yeah.
That thing is not even at half charge yet.
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing how long that Pro Controller is lasting me, battery-wise. And I will say, like, it was the $70 thing. Last week, I was kind of trying to figure out how to make a recommendation. I have no problem with the $70 thing for the Pro Controller anymore. If for no other reason than if that allowed them to put a battery in there that lasts that long, I will happily pay the extra $10 for that. I like that feature.
I would speculate that that is not why it is more expensive. Sure, that's not really how that works. But
it's nice. I mean, we have... it's by no means a deal breaker on the DualShock 4, and I don't mean to say that as I think some people do. The DualShock 4 has low battery life, less than 10 hours. It's not that much of a problem because you can really easily charge it.
Because if you are playing video games for so long that you have gone from a full charge DualShock 4 to having like it turning off, you have done something wrong, like really seriously. You should go outside.
Yeah. The only way a controller's charge is going to be bad is if it won't make you through a single play session, right? And the DualShock 4 is nowhere near that. But it is, if you ever have a lapse and forget to plug it in one night and then you get up, it can be an annoying thing. And I like that about the Switch controller, that you can just leave it and leave it and leave it, and that's nice.
Yeah.
So just it's the biggest weakness of the DualShock 4 to me, which is otherwise to me kind of a perfect controller.
Yeah.
And the Xbox One doesn't even have charging. And if you want it, you have to pay $24 extra. So if you're talking about hidden costs, that's a real hidden cost.
Yes.
Yeah. Because most, just look, you don't have batteries for literally anything else anymore. The Xbox One controller should not have that thing. Or at least give you the option out of the box. Because I know some people like being able to put batteries in, at least give you the battery pack and stuff. It's stupid that they don't.
Yeah.
So I just like that the Switch controller is, you know, $5 to $10 more expensive than the competition. Because I've actually seen a lot of the new Xbox One controllers are up to $65. At their list price. Like, the colored versions of the S controller are not $60, they're $65.
That's weird.
Which is weird.
Yeah.
But anyway, so for the Switch, for me, it's like, that's one of those things, I like that so much about it. And the other thing is, because I got the Pro Controller, I now have an extra USB-C cable, because they give you that with the Pro Controller for charging. And so I've been trying to charge the Switch itself, like the device, in other contexts to see, like, outside of the dock, outside of the main AC adapter, what will and won't charge this thing. If you're going from, like, a regular phone adapter or something, that is not enough power to charge it fast enough to, like, actually play a game off of it. But I found one thing that a lot of people might have that I think is a good solution that they might... I have not seen in other articles. If you have an iPad, the charger they give you with that, which is, like, a bigger white little box, because the iPad has a bigger power draw than an iPhone.
Right.
But you can still plug any USB device into that. Works great with the Switch. If you have one of those, you can plug a USB-C cable into that, and it will charge fast enough that you can play, and it will charge at the same time. And I like that. That means I don't have to, like, buy another box for that or anything. So, because I've seen a lot of articles about, like, what kind of thing you want.
Yeah, like what kind of battery pack is compatible and stuff like that.
And if you don't, but a lot of people have iPads, so I just thought, like, that's something that, oh, that works, and that's cool to have. So I just noticed that today, and I ran a test with that, and I was like, this works well. So. Cool. You know, I have not played for hours doing that or anything, but it worked. I downloaded a game doing that while I was playing Zelda, and it went up, not down. So that's how you know it's working.
Yep.
All right. So anyway, just more Switch stuff. Like my Switch. It's fun.
Cool.
Yeah. Let's move on.
Let's move on.
To something that I don't think is fun.
Mass Effect Andromeda.
All right. Look, you guys might not think this because we do talk about stuff we don't like on this podcast from time to time.
Yeah.
But I think you'd be surprised at how much we hold back on that. I don't, Sean, tell me if you think I'm wrong. I think generally if we don't like something, we step away from it and we kind of ignore it.
Yes, yeah.
Unless it's something pressing like Batman v Superman that we paid to see. It's like, no way, we're not tearing that apart.
Yeah.
Like part of the zeitgeist kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of stuff I play that, you know, or try or something that I'm just not going to bring it up because I don't like to add extra negativity. I prefer to talk about things I like or at least find interesting.
Yeah.
Things like that, you know. Like a couple weeks ago, got the new Digimon game, the Digimon World Next Order. You haven't heard me talk about it because it wasn't really for me. And I kind of put it away. But I don't need to put that energy into the world.
Right.
And so there's a long way of saying, I don't take any joy out of bashing Mass Effect Andromeda for that reason. And because Mass Effect is one of my favorite things in the world.
Yes.
So when I say I am not just disappointed in Mass Effect Andromeda, but I think what I have played is just bad. And I'm not going to dance around it. I just think it's bad. I don't think it's promising and shows. No, I just think it's bad. And I don't take any joy in saying that. It makes me very sad to say that. In the same way, I think the Halo 5 campaign is just bad.
Yeah.
And it's got things that are interesting about it. Same thing with Mass Effect Andromeda. But, you know, these are parts of long-running series that I look at, and they make me sad, both because they are bad and because they are part of that long-running series. So, you know, I don't even know where to start with Andromeda. One of the things you said early on is this game should have been delayed.
Yes. Clearly, we have talked about that a lot on this podcast recently.
And it should have been, but this game is bad from a bunch of different directions. And it's bad from directions where no amount of delaying would have fixed it, I don't think. Like, I think there are fundamental underlying things going on here, and one of them is it doesn't feel like Mass Effect to me. Okay. It feels like an imitation of Mass Effect, and maybe a passable imitation of Mass Effect here and there, but, you know, I never like to read too much into these things until I have the game or the movie or whatever in hand. But it feels like Casey Hudson not working on this and other, you know, BioWare has changed a lot since Mass Effect 3. Yeah. This does not feel like a game made by the same people who made Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3.
I mean, it wasn't. Like, I mean, it quite literally wasn't. It is a different team at BioWare, like, straight up. Like, it's not even just that, because you're right, like, both there are people like Casey Hudson that were working at BioWare that were, you know, creative leads on the Mass Effect franchise who have left. But even on top of that, like, it is handed off to BioWare Montreal, I think it is. So it is a completely different team that has been working on this.
And you feel it. You just feel it kind of in everything. And I should back up and say how much I've played. I have the EA Access trial. And if you want to try it out, it's a good way to do it. EA Access only costs $5 for a month, and you can immediately cancel it. So for $5, you can try the game for 10 hours. That's how I viewed it. And I'm like, that's a perfectly fair price to try this thing out.
That's like renting it when Blockbuster was still a thing.
Sure. Yeah. Or if you are one of the crazy people who uses Redbox.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Which
I see it at, like, the gas station I go to, and I'm like, why? Anyway, but, yeah, so, yeah, you can basically rent it for 10 hours and get a feeling for it, and that's a great way to do it. I know at least on PC, and maybe, I think Xbox probably has a way to do this, your save will carry over if you buy the full game, so, like, there's not a, and I got achievements and everything, so that's nice. It's a really nice way they do it. EA Access generally seems like a pretty cool service if you use that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
If you play their kind of games. Especially
now that, like, they have enough games on, like, this generation of consoles for it to kind of make sense.
Like, they got Dragon Age Inquisition on there.
Right, yeah.
Which, hey, you could do a lot worse than pay $5 and play Dragon Age Inquisition for a month. Because that game will take you more than a month.
Yes, yeah.
Anyway, it's the persona of open-world RPGs. Not necessarily in quality, but in quantity.
Sure, yeah.
Anyway. And Dragon Quest Inquisition, much better game than this. But, no, it just feels different. Like, so what I was saying is, so I've got the trial. I've played probably upwards of 3 hours, but below five. I don't know. I've gotten through, like, the first big mission, which means I've gotten off the first planet. I've gotten to this game's version of the Citadel and kind of that sort of thing and working with that. And I've opened up, like, the different avenues I can go to in the game. So there is a lot left. And I am not trying to say the game as a whole is bad. But what I have played of it is bad and does not make me want to play more. So maybe it gets great later on. I don't know. What I've played, like, it was really hard not to, every time I was playing this, turn it off and go play more Zelda. And that's one, that's an unfair comparison, because I consider Breath of the Wild one of the best games ever made, and you shouldn't hold anything up to something you hold in that as regard.
Right.
But still, it's sitting right there. And Andromeda, that game actually throws into stark relief some of the things that are bad about Andromeda. So, but yeah, going back to that main point that it just doesn't feel like Mass Effect, you know, early on, they has their first cutscene, and then you wake up from cryo sleep, and you start having your conversations with the dialogue wheel. Like, nothing more Mass Effect than that.
Right.
You're talking to an Asari, and you have a dialogue wheel, right? With your player-created character. That's where you're going to see if it feels like Mass Effect or not.
Right.
And the first thing you'll notice is the writing in this game is really bad. And I'm not saying it's kind of awkward. No, it's awful writing. In fact, let me get my phone out and just go through my Twitter timeline, because I've been tweeting different examples of horrible dialogue in this game. And a lot of it is like just banter, but some of it is bigger than that. So let me see if I can get back far enough to find one of these. Okay, here's some battle banter from the first planet. I think I really pissed that one off. Maybe because I shot him in the face. Who wrote that? And will you please go fuck yourself?
That sounds like a line from, like, Gears of War or something, you know?
Gears of War on an off day.
Yeah.
Let's see. When you become the Pathfinder, not a spoiler, it's what you are in the game, someone says to you, this is your moment, you just need to decide what you're going to do with it. Did they write this based on fortune cookies? That's not good dialogue.
No.
Let's see. Oh, my favorite one from today. This was a character you're talking to, and he says, it seems murder isn't exclusive to the Milky Way. And that is part of a amazing amount of dialogue in the first, like, few hours of this game, where they say some variation on the line, we're not in the Milky Way anymore.
Oh, yeah.
They say the words Milky Way more than people at Nestle advertising a candy bar. I don't know if Milky Way belongs to Nestle, but you get my point.
Maybe
it's Hershey's, who knows. But, like, they say that so fucking much, and it's horrendous, some of the dialogue in here. And just all of it is stiff. It feels like, at best, a first pass of dialogue, like someone is just getting it off the printer as fast as they can and being like, we'll test this to see if it works. Oh, wait, that's the final dialogue for the game? Shit, my career's over. Like, that kind of would be my reaction if that dialogue went out into the world. Like, there's some early scenes where kind of the story set up for this game, everyone knows you're going to the Andromeda Galaxy and stuff. You play as one of the Ryder twins. They are the son and daughter of Alec Ryder, who is the Pathfinder. He's the guy who has, like, leading this expedition. And you have an early inspirational speech from Mr. Alec Ryder, who is played by a famous character actor, and I forget his name right now, but it's an actor who is a great actor, but clearly very uncomfortable with doing the voice acting in mocap. Two, having to read terrible inspirational dialogue. Three, looks like a video game character from maybe the late 90s. If we're being generous of, like, 3D modeling of characters. I would say most of the facial animation looks like early 360 era, like pre-Mass Effect 1.
Right.
That character in particular looks pre-360 era, like PS2 if we're being generous. And, like, his eyes go in different directions and things like that.
Is he supposed to be a lizard man? Because it's Mass Effect. We have lizard people.
No, he's not. Like, the aliens look okay. The humans, though, Jesus Christ. Anyway, so you have those scenes that are bad. All the dialogue. And, like, I remember, like, playing on that main planet, and that first planet is bad in a lot of ways in terms of level design and the story stuff that happens there. Mostly, though, you've got your first teammates, and the banter between them is just so bad. Like, they're trying to establish who Ryder is as a character. I'm playing Sarah Ryder. So, and it'll be like, Sarah will go and, like, shoot an alien. And then her friend will be like, man, where'd you learn to shoot like that? And Sarah will be like, well, when I was a teenager, I trained with this division of something or something. And she just lists off her resume. And it's like, that's not good character building. Mass Effect 1 never felt the need to do that with Commander Shepard.
Yeah.
Commander Shepard was a character. And then a few minutes later, Ryder will scan something, like a plant or an animal or something. Be like, man, Ryder, how are you so good at scanning shit? She's like, well, I was a Boy Scout or I don't know, I forget what it was, but, like, I was on a biotic team that did organic research. And, like, there are multiple just over and over. It's like, well, when I was a kid, I did. And just, like, listing her resume. And the actress is fine. She's good. She's no Jennifer Hale in Mass Effect 1, 2, 3. But she seems fine. She's one of the better actors in the game. But when she's given some of that dialogue, you can hear her, like, is this really what you want me to read for your marquee video game with this new character who's replacing Commander Shepard, one of the most beloved protagonists in gaming? Is this really how you want to introduce this character? And apparently it was. So you've got that kind of stuff.
Is there anything like in Mass Effect 1 how you could pick, like, I'm like a lone survivor, like, well, you know, you have those, like, two things of like your history?
You have like history in terms of like where you served, but it's not as dramatic as like that shaped Shepard's personality.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to here. Like,
I guess what I'm asking is like, are those scenes of like, how do you know how to do this? Does that call back to you making a choice about like, I was a colonist, spaceborn colonist man who's ruthless or something?
Maybe there are some of those later. I don't think they are, because her being able to scan stuff and shoot stuff, no matter what writer has to do those things for the story. So I don't know. It would be weird if that wasn't just something everyone has. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because there's not like alternate versions where Ryder isn't good at scanning. That's a key function of the game. Anyway, so you have all that. The stuff on the planet is where I really started to like, I don't want to play this game. I like had to go in like 30-minute chunks because it's really awkward, and I'll get back to some of that stuff. But I kept thinking like, I want to get off this planet and get back to a ship and do dialogue wheels, because I was getting like nostalgic for the dialogue wheels from the first hour of the game. And I was like, those weren't great, but maybe they'll get better. That's where Mass Effect is good. Like, I get to talk to a Turian and talk to them and stuff, and that'll be fun.
Right.
And I get back and I'm like, no, it's still bad. It's still bad. All the dialogue's bad. It's like that line I said about there's still murder in the Milky Way. That was me talking to a Corian, who's one of my favorite races. And this Corian was just boring, and the other Corian was boring. And the Krogan was boring, and the Turians were less boring, but they're not in it much yet. So, yeah.
Have you seen, and because obviously this is at the beginning of the game, so who knows like how much they would put this here, but have you seen anything of like, oh, this is like some crazy shit going on in the Andromeda Galaxy that is not like just like Corians and Geth and all the stuff you know from Mass Effect?
And I was going to save this for later, but let's talk about it now.
Okay.
I think this game has a really creative premise that they use as lazily as possible.
Okay.
Like, lazily as humanly possible, at least in the early going. I actually like the first scene and kind of the setup is this takes place around the time of Mass Effect 2 is the beginning of it. And all these people are boarding these arcs, these big ships that are going to transport, like, 20,000 humans, 20,000 Asari, like, all of the big races are going to Andromeda. And they're going to, like, colonize a planet together and have a new settlement out there in Andromeda. And so it's kind of cool. You're like, oh, this is, like, during Mass Effect, 2185. And then, like, the ships leave, and it cuts to 600 years later. And you're like, that's interesting. Like, they are so far removed from the events of the trilogy now.
Yeah, all those people are fucking dead no matter what you did in Mass Effect
right.
1, 2, and 3.
It's a pretty clever way of sidestepping that, I think. And you're in a new galaxy. And you get to Andromeda, and the story setup is, of course, that, you know, your dad is the Pathfinder. Spoiler, you eventually become the Pathfinder.
What?
Yeah. Anyway, you do not just follow
in this BioWare game, you start out as, like, someone who's just, like, kind of skilled but has no official position, and then at some point over the course of the story early on in the game, you then adopt this official position as the Jedi / Spectre / Warden / Inquisitor / Pathfinder.
You do.
/ whatever the fuck you became in Jade Empire, like, the master martial artist person. Yes. It's literally every single one of their games does that. It's kind of absurd at some point.
As
somebody who's played, I think, every single BioWare game, at least played, if not necessarily to completion, other than Dragon Age 2,
yeah,
they use that plot device a whole lot.
And usually it's good.
Yeah, I'm usually fine with it.
So anyway, like, you have a planet already scoped out. I don't know how the science of that works, but they have a planet scoped out. And so you're going to get there and you're going to start scoping out these planets. And, of course, you arrive there, and something's gone wrong with the planet you were going to look at, so you decide to go down to the surface. So far, so good, right? And it's like, okay, this is where things are going to get crazy.
Yeah.
And here's where I have to talk about colonialism in games.
Okay.
Because it's a problem. I think it's a problem Mass Effect, the trilogy, largely sidesteps by being an interesting version of a sci-fi future where the world already exists. The community of the Mass Effect Milky Way galaxy exists. Humans are somewhat new to it, but not entirely.
Yeah.
And so, like, the factions, the good guys, the bad guys, all of that is there. You are not Commander Shepard going to, like, wipe out another species and take their planet. It's like this hierarchy exists, and your place in it kind of exists. And the bad guys you're fighting in those games are established, like, aggressors of the universe.
Yeah.
You know? So if you go to a planet and you're, like, killing... Like, who are the villains in the first game? I don't know.
The Geth, mostly.
The Geth, yeah. It doesn't feel gross in the way it does in Mass Effect Andromeda, where you come to a new galaxy. It's something that Mass Effect has always been great at and feels like something Andromeda could maximize, which is that sense of exploration. And you hear early on, like, what's our first contact protocol and that kind of stuff. And you're like, great, I'm going to meet new aliens. We're going to talk to them because Mass Effect has guns and stuff, but the best part of BioWare games is the talking, right?
Yeah.
And that's going to be cool. And what is the first thing you do when you get on the surface of the planet in Mass Effect Andromeda is you meet an alien, it looks mean, and you fucking shoot it, and then you spend 2 hours shooting aliens without knowing what they are, without really making any effort to...
Are they, like, other, like, sentient? Do they seem like they are sentient? Like, you should be able to communicate with them if you're creative enough?
Yeah. And, you know, you can choose to try. Like, you kind of half-heartedly go up with your arms raised and see if they want to talk, but they don't. And at no point does anyone talk about how, hey, what's the morality of us coming to another galaxy and trying to steal these people's planet? Like, yeah, they're trying to kill us, but this is their planet. Like, that's not, and I guess later in the story you learn that they've been aggressing other, like the Turians got there before you, and they've been aggressing, but that's not an excuse, I think, for, like, the basis of the story.
Right.
It feels really gross to me.
Yeah, it's like real, like, Manifest Destiny type shit.
Absolutely, and it's because, like, and they're throwing around the words, we're gonna colonize this planet, and all this stuff. You go down armed to the teeth, and you just start killing the native inhabitants, and no one mentions it. Like, it feels to me like there's a theme running through this game that the game is unaware of, but it could be where, like, maybe the twist ending is Ryder realizes what they're doing is utterly fucking wrong, and the bad guys are, like, her commanders, and you have to take them out and then leave Andromeda and be like, we're gonna go home. Or something, you know,
sure,
like, we'll get there in 600 years, but this isn't our place. Like, you know, we were wrong to do this, and we pissed them off, and, you know, we kind of deserve what we got. But, and it's because the game has no, like, intellectual curiosity of these things early on. It's purely you get to this first planet, and you shoot stuff. You don't even, like, go around and look at the flora and fauna. You kind of, I don't know if you even can, like, you do some scanning, but the first scanning you do is of a dead alien body. They introduce the scanning mechanic through a dead alien body. Well, they do a little bit on the ship with, like, a broken mechanic part, but mostly they introduce it through a dead alien body that you killed, not through, like, here's a plant, it looks cool. Like, and it is something that I think of, like, Zelda Breath of the Wild, and obviously, totally, completely different game. Zelda, you do, like, kill a bunch of moblins and stuff.
Oh, I am fucking wiping those fuckers out.
But one...
And then they get resurrected by the magical blood moon, and I fucking put them in the ground again.
Yes. But, one, those are literally servants of a Dark Lord Ganon.
Yeah, great way to be racist, motherfucker. Yeah, oh, they serve Ganon. Let's just kill him. That's fine.
No, it's literally in the story of the game. They're like incarnations of his evil. Anyway.
You probably think it's super, super cool to go around killing orcs too, huh?
But, like, you know, in Breath of the Wild, they encourage this natural interest in nature to pick flowers and to get apples and to take pictures of wildlife and all this stuff that, you
take pictures of wildlife, fucking throw bombs at those fuckers and eat their tasty meat.
I do not kill the animals in Zelda. I like them too much.
I have more food than I can... I literally have more food than I can eat.
Nice. Anyway, but so there's, you know, that's something that I love about that game so intensely. And when you go to this game, it feels like it is, Andromeda feels like it's very much stuck in the mindset of these places, however good they look, are killing grounds. That's
right.
You're there to kill people, kill things. And that's not interesting to me. And, you know, some of that is just we are 5 years past Mass Effect 3 and gaming has evolved.
And also, like, not to say, like, this was possible throughout all of Mass Effect, but there were lots of situations in those games where if you had... I mean, even, like, the last boss fight of Mass Effect 1 against Saren, like, if you have the right skills and, like, the Paragon or whatever, like, you can talk your way out of situations and de-escalate things. I mean, that's something that's important for a lot of BioWare games. Like, if you can't do that for everything, but you can usually at least try whether or not the game will let you de-escalate the situation or not.
Yeah, but... You know, like, and generally I think this game graphically looks pretty bad. I think, for the most part, it looks like a 360 game. It does not look like an Xbox One or PS4 game to me. A little bit more if you look at it on PC. Like, my brother has it on PC, and I got to see him playing it a little bit. And, you know, he's got, like, his 4K monitor, 60 frames per second. Of course, it's going to look better. But generally, this game looks does not look very good to me. And the planet that you're on looks more good. It looks better. It's got some interesting design and skyboxes, but... There's nothing to it. Like, there's nothing to interact with there. Like, there are some, like, little, what look like plants and stuff, but there was no game mechanic around it from what I could see. And so, again, it's a pretty place to kill people. And that just didn't interest me. Especially, again, Breath of the Wild is an incredibly beautiful game that is aesthetically overwhelming, but those aesthetics, you can interact with all of them in meaningful ways. Like, if you see a mountain and it looks cool, you climb it or something. There's none of that to this. And with kind of how it's pitching itself... And maybe it opens up when you get to other planets and stuff, but at least on this opening planet, it really rubbed me the wrong way right off the bat. And part of that is also the game controls like ass. Like,
oh.
And I'm on record, I love the combat in Mass Effect 2 and 3.
Yeah.
2 especially, but, and I know people think in different ways, 3 is also, It's like, to me, like a tiny, tiny, tiny little notch beneath. For other people, it's like notch above,
right,
different ways. But they're both great, and they really cleaned it up. And they feel snappy and quick and good and not overly complex, but like, you know, kind of an easy to learn, hard to master sort of thing.
Yeah.
This just feels like mud to me. And they've added like all this, the buzzword of the day, all the movement stuff, where, yes, you have your jetpack and you have your thing where you move sideways. And part of it is the controls make precious little sense. Like, you use A to jump, and if you hold A down, you can jump higher with your jetpack, but you use B to like jump side to side with your jetpack. And sometimes when you're in cover, you clamber with A, but sometimes you clamber over it with B, and sometimes you clamber just by moving against it. And honestly, I don't know how you really clamber, because it's very confusing. And you run by holding down the stick, you melee by pressing Y, which feels a little weird, and they have so many buttons they have to use that to like put your gun away or you access the weapon wheel, you hit the back button or the select button. Who knows what it's called on the Xbox One, but you know what button I mean.
The view button, yeah. I think.
And if you were doing that on PS4, you would hit the touchpad,
right,
which is just weird. It's a weird button placement to me. So there's things like that. There's just the controls are awkward. But then just the way you move and everything, like I feel, like the controls just feel very slippery to me. Like I don't have a lot of control over Ryder. Sometimes I'll try to push her in one direction and she'll kind of go another. Or she doesn't really stop when I stop. It kind of feels like a platformer on the Game Boy in that way. But that's okay on that, because that's just the name of the game there. This is not that. So you just don't feel like, even though there's a lot more control options, I don't feel a ton of control over Ryder. And it just feels very slippery to me, as I said. I don't know what I feel about the combat yet. I thought the combat scenarios were very dry, rote, by the numbers. They are Gears of War. Here's some cover. They're over there. Get cover. Shoot them. Blah, blah. You have your biotic abilities, but at least in these first combat encounters, the game is really encouraging you just to use your guns. And to me, that's never where Mass Effect is at its best with, yeah, its combat. And so there's a lot of places where you kind of just forget you have your biotics, because this isn't necessarily the best place to use them. Once I started using them, I enjoyed it more, but it still just felt a little awkward, especially because there's so little emphasis put on it at the start. So it just, like, the combat just felt like, okay, I ran out of ammo, go get some more ammo, go shoot some more aliens in the head. Oh, I can use my pull ability, and then I can shoot them, and okay, this is kind of interesting. But it's just, it was very rote to me, and I did not, I just, it felt like a bloated, messier version of combat from Mass Effect 3, where ultimately is where I kind of feel about it. And then there's another issue, and this is another thing that I'm contrasting it with Zelda, but the whole game looks cluttered to me. And this is a harder thing to say, but just because you can't, and this is actually an interesting topic, I think, for all video games right now, given, yeah, the technology we have. Just because you can put a lot of stuff in your world and in your frame doesn't necessarily mean you should, because you don't want to overclutter what we're looking at. And that first planet especially, but I also think like the ships you're on and some of this stuff, the visuals of the game just look cluttered. Like there's just a lot in the world that is not necessary to play with, and it's kind of visually overwhelming. And I actually got like a little bit of a headache playing it the first night. That might have also been from fatigue, because I had to get up at 6 to go do something, but it was still, it's just like I got, it like, it hurt my eyes a little bit, added with a HUD that is really overwhelming, I think, and some, and also like the text is way too small and some of that stuff. And it just, the whole game looked cluttered to me and like visually loud in a way that didn't feel right to me. Mm-hmm. And some of that is just that it's one of the things I love about Breath of the Wild is, even though you have this kind of big world with these huge draw distances and it looks beautiful, there's not too much in it to like overwhelm your kind of senses when you're looking at it. There's not like, you know, 100 enemies over there or something. Generally, you know, you can
look. Thank God there's not 100 enemies over there, because that game would not be able to move.
No, of course not. But like, it's just, it's generally like, and also because the HUD is very understated, the UI is very understated in Zelda, and it's, there's never too much on screen with that, and you can even turn it all down,
yeah,
if you want.
Yeah, you play it on pro HUD mode, because that's the only way to play that game. Get that fucking sound meter off my screen, I don't want it.
Anyway, but like, but even if you have it on there, it's this little thing in the bottom. Sure, yeah. It doesn't distract necessarily, and so, you know, you're really, it doesn't feel like visually loud to me in that way. It feels very visually welcoming and inviting. And it's a subtle line and it's a small, yeah, line, but I think it's a line video games need to learn to walk. I felt this about Gears of War 4 when I played that. I think I feel this about parts of Halo 5. I'm just thinking, yeah, of other recent games that I think,
I mean, that is a lot of my experience of when I played the beta for Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon Wildlands. I complained there of like, there's like specific things in that game about like the lack of anti-aliasing on a lot of the foliage, making it shimmer in a weird way. But it's just like you say, it's this visual clutter and this sort of almost like claustrophobic feeling of like there's so much detail, so many objects on screen with like no care put into like what this sort of visual information is meant to convey, and it's why like every single fucking video game in the world has to have a like Batman Detective Vision style mechanic, because you cannot discern things in the environment. And it's like, and that is one of the things that Zelda does very well with, it's like, you know, it has a great art style and it's very smart at using visual cues to let you know like that glint is a sword that is on the ground or whatever. And I think there are like Horizon Zero Dawn, I think, is a game that is very good at both looking really good and looking very technically impressive, but also still allowing you to be like, okay, like I can look at this environment and immediately read, that's where I can hide, like that's a climbing point I can do over there, like there's like some resources on the ground, and I know everything I need to know just by glancing at the screen. But a lot of video games do not have that kind of clarity because, like you say, they want to just put every single little object on the screen and have so much visual information without thinking about what that actually like looks like to the player.
Yeah. You know, one way I would describe this is really in a lot of these Mass Effect scenarios I've seen so far, all you're really doing is following a path.
Right. I mean, you should be finding your path, not following it. You're the path finder.
All right, you're finding it, whatever. But you're going, you know, you're actually going on a pretty small sliver of what is on screen. And it becomes cluttered where there's a lot of stuff, and you're like, well, can I climb? No, I can't. So why? Okay, there's big. Half the screen I can't interact with. Okay, well, half that's okay. I can interact with the middle of the screen.
Right.
And it's something where Zelda, you can interact with all whatever the hell you want. You can go to the furthest edge of that screen and interact with it, but it never feels visually loud and cluttered. And that's a really important thing to do. With Mass Effect, if anything, you need to pare down as much as you can for some of these if you are going on kind of a linear path. And I know other worlds will be more open, but I also know Mass Effect does not have like a Zelda-esque climbing mechanic, so there's a lot of stuff in there that is just window dressing, and you have to limit that, or else it gets visually loud and claustrophobic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's part of it. So, you know, yeah, those graphics, they look nicer there, but I think they're distracting and also just very generic modern sci-fi shooter. Like, it looks like Halo 4 or 5 or something. It does not look like anything particularly special. Like, there's nothing in this game that feels like that kind of special Mass Effect art style. Like, they do the, you know, grainy thing on the image a little bit, but it just feels as like they did that because Mass Effect 1 and 2 did it, not because they felt like that was something core to the game.
Right.
And actually becomes really distracting where I'm not sure how the frame rate works with this game, because mostly it seems fine at 30. But whenever I turn the camera, like that motion, there's a ton of motion blur.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know if that's frame rate going down. I don't know if that's intentional motion blur they've thrown on it. But it makes me like queasy and it looks bad and it makes me not want to move the camera, which it's a 3D, you know,
third-person shooter.
You need to move the camera.
Yeah, that's sort of a core part of what you're doing.
Yeah. Like, you know, say what you will about the frame rate of Breath of the Wild, at least it doesn't, like, blur horribly when you move the camera around. Yeah. It's perfectly smooth, and you can just play the game. So, that's all problem. Let's talk about the character animations.
Okay, yeah. I've avoided watching much in the way of videos, just because I just haven't even had time, and I don't want to. There's still a chance that I'm going to play this game, though. Like, I'm definitely not getting it at launch. But yeah, I have just seen a lot of GIFs of very awkward animations. I think my favorite GIF I saw was of you're a sorry teammate lady in like a cutscene pulling out a gun and shooting a thing, but she was holding the gun backwards in the cutscene, so it was like the handle was pointing towards it, and just like a muzzle flare shoots out of the back of the handle of the gun, and it looked really funny.
And, you know, it would be easy to say, oh, that's just the GIFs, that's just select moments.
Yeah.
But when you're playing the game, it's constant. It's every interaction with everything. As I said, with aliens, it's better, although you mentioned a scene where if the Asari's face looks better, the everything else might not.
Yeah.
So that's a problematic. But, like, it's just, especially with human characters, and in the early going, the game is mostly human characters. There is no facial animation this bad in the current generation of consoles. There is no facial animation this bad in all of the Mass Effect trilogy. It is regressive to a level that I didn't think was, and I think a lot of people didn't think was possible given our current hardware and everything. Like, especially with the father character, Alec Ryder, who looks especially just like, you know, running like Halo 3 in the Master Chief Collection, where it's running at 60 FPS and 1080p, and you look at like the character models from back then and you're like, whoa, like thrown under that light, they don't look so good.
Right.
He looks like that. He really does look like that, only a little worse. And it's just, that's especially crazy, but it's like people's eyes don't look at each other. Sometimes their eyes are going in separate directions. Lip movement and lip sync is very hit or miss, which I don't know how you mess that up these days. Ryder herself, like, you create your character and everything. And I thought I created a pretty cool-looking character. At least I liked my writer. And then when I got into cutscenes, I immediately started role-playing her as a complete and utter sociopath because her eyes looked cold and dead, and she refused to make eye contact with anybody. And it's like, yeah, she's broken inside.
I mean, that's how I played my shepherd. Not for that reason, well, but there you go. That is how I played my shepherd.
Yeah,
so there you go. Maybe they just heard that this podcast we talked about, Mass Effect 3 Forever Go. They're like, hey, let's just do that.
But, yeah, but my writer, like, your shepherd didn't sound like a hugely disturbed sociopath.
No.
Writer looks like a really disturbed sociopath. Like, someone hurt her.
Okay.
Yeah, like, it's scary. And there's just a lot of, like, they look like melting, misshapen mannequins. They don't look like characters, let alone people. And there is going to be an inherent amount of awkwardness in how BioWare does cutscenes. There always has been. There always will be because of the amount of technical complexity going on there.
Yeah.
But we've learned to live with that. Like, that doesn't bother me in the Mass Effect trilogy. Didn't bother me in Dragon Quest Inquisition. Dragon Age Inquisition.
Dragon Quest Inquisition would be a very different game.
That would be an even longer game.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, didn't bother me in Dragon Age Inquisition. But here it's that coupled with... I mean, it's clearly not done. Like, that, this, I mean, and I think this about the whole game. This game looks like the alpha version of itself. Like, I think when you're, the planet looked a little more modern, but everything else, the ships and all the cutscenes, look like a 360 game to me. And just the way the visuals kind of just jump up and down in quality, and some of the places they hide loading screens that feel really weird and lazy, and some of all the character animation stuff, that's where you most feel like, right, this game wasn't anywhere near done. And then you add all those other things that I think are not so much a completion thing, just, I think, bad decisions at the underlying heart of the game thing.
I mean, at some point, the writing is the writing. Like, you can't take that all back and redo it.
Yeah. So, but man, those character animations, and to me, that's one of those things that just, like, it's already been, that horse has been beaten to death, but it is a problem because it's one of the primary things you interface with in Mass Effect, and it just looks like shit. It just, and it's distracting. It's actively distracting.
Yeah, and then, like, especially like you said earlier, it's been 5 years since Mass Effect 3. It's been 3 years, actually, because Dragon Age Inquisition was a 2014 game. Like, other than Inquisition, which was very early in this generation, this is, like, the big BioWare game of this generation so far, and it feels like this is the one where, like, they should be finding their groove as a studio, because they cut their teeth on Inquisition, that it's, like, a good-looking game, has some weird animation stuff that, like, clearly, like, things needed to be worked out, and it just feels like there's this... It's this massive bummer of BioWare being one of, like, personally my favorite studios ever, like, going all the way back to Knights of the Old Republic and then playing the Baldur's Gate games later... And stuff like that, and then, like, going up all the way through the Mass Effect games and Dragon Age. Like, I've just loved their stuff so much, and it's really frustrating to look at, like, hear what you're saying and look at, like, some of the stuff I've seen from this game. And it looking like they haven't, like, not only have they not improved on the things that you were hoping they would improve on, like you said, it feels like they're, like, going backwards somehow in ways that, like, you just don't normally see. And part of, and like, some of that you can understand is this being, this is not necessarily the exact same studio. Like, it is BioWare, but it's a different part of BioWare making this game. But it is still really, really frustrating to see that this is how this game is coming out.
And there's just so many other things we could talk about. Like, the UI in this game is awful, and it's part of the reason I don't want to play the whole game, is I don't want to interface with it. Like, I have had my fill of open world games with overly complex systems and bad UIs and stuff like that. And just, like, the way, like, the quest, like, 3 hours in, you have this insane quest log already, and it's, the way that is organized, like, defies comprehension. It's like 6 different folders, and you can open the folders, and then there are subfolders, and in the subfolders, eventually there might be more subfolders, I don't know, but within those subfolders you have your missions, and you can choose from there, but it, like, saves your place, so sometimes I'll be looking for a mission, and I'll go into that journal, but it'll have saved which folder I was in, and then I'll be like, why aren't my other missions showing up, and I have to press B to go back, which feels really counterintuitive, so I can go up the scale of folders to find where I am, and I'm sorry, 3 hours into a game, you do not want any of that, because that just loses players. I can already see there's all this open world garbage stuff of, like, you can loot the bodies and get all the things, and then you can have the crafting materials. But I don't need any of that.
Have you found some, like, collectible that popped up a thing on screen that said, like, 1 of 5,000? You're like, oh god,
not yet. But
I remember Dragon Age Inquisition had a couple of those of like the slab pieces and the shards, and it was just like, oh god, no. Yeah. Every time you would pick up a shard and see the thing pop up on screen, it was like out of like 300 or something ridiculous, like, just fucking kill me now, I don't want to do this.
Yeah, I don't want to have any interest in playing more of this game, and it breaks my heart to say that. Yeah. But it's also, I mean, it's also coming out at a time where it's going to be really easy, not just for people like you and me, but more casual players to cut their losses on this one, because there are so many other games out.
I really want to play that Nier game. The more and more I've seen of Nier Automata, it looks exactly like a game I really should play.
Looks great. If you want your open world fix, take your fucking pick, because you got Horizon, you got Zelda, you got other stuff that is out and coming out. If you want your RPG fix, hey, Persona 5 is coming your way.
Yes, that will fix you.
This game inspires nothing from me, and I think the most damning thing I can say about this is throughout its development, throughout its weird-ass marketing cycle, we kept just saying, like, what is this game? Yeah. I don't have any sense of what the pitch on this game is.
Never had a trailer at an E3. Like, never a proper trailer at an E3.
Or a proper trailer that just felt like a good video game trailer. Uh-huh. Period. And wherever it was. And you never got that feeling of, like, what is this game I am getting? The way you get from if you watch a Breath of the Wild trailer or a Persona 5 trailer or a Horizon Zero Dawn trailer or something like that. And that feeling continues 100% into playing the game, where I'm 3 or 4 hours in, I see what the gameplay loop is, I see what I have to do, and I still have, I could not tell you in like a sentence what Mass Effect Andromeda is, and I don't think the game has a clear sense of what it is or of its identity. I think it's a game that was made because Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3 were successful, and the accountants wanted to make another one. I don't see anything in this that suggests creatively anyone had a reason to make another Mass Effect.
Man, that's a bummer.
Yeah, I mean, I would compare this a lot to, like, and I think I was thinking this in the build-up to Jason Bourne last year, the new Jason Bourne movie, where I think in the lead-up, I was excited for that because it's more Bourne, and that's this great trilogy, but I was also trepidatious because that trilogy ended very definitively, but I was like, we'll wait and see, but then all the marketing for that movie just looked like nothing, and then the movie was nothing, and Mass Effect Andromeda has had the exact same cycle to me, and the game is just kind of nothing. So...
Well, I have the most important question about this game. One, is there a galaxy map in this game?
I believe so. I haven't seen it.
Okay, because my second question was going to be, is there new galaxy map music because you're in a new galaxy? It's just the number one thing I want to know about this game the whole time.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sorry. Yeah, because I actually did try to get back to my ship to leave for another planet, and the layout of, like, the base you're in is so confusing I couldn't figure it out. And I turned it off in frustration and went back to playing Zelda and instantly became happy again. So.
Okay, here's another, maybe even more important question. Have you had sex with any aliens in the game?
No.
Oh, that's a bummer.
I feel like that takes more than 3 hours in most Mass Effect games.
You know, it's a new game. It's a new character. You never know what this might be.
There's an Asari played by Natalie Dormer from Game of Thrones.
Okay.
You probably can fuck her. If not, that'd be weird, but
it's an Asari, you know. It's how that game goes.
Asaris like to, do it.
I mean, they do with anything and everything. It's part of their species. It's part of their biology, really, when you get down to it. It's sort of weird.
All right. Well, that's Mass Effect Andromeda. Da-da-da.
Yeah.
All right. Legend of Zelda, Breath of the Wild. Mild spoilers throughout this, with the caveat that this is a game that it's really hard to define what a spoiler is and isn't.
Yeah.
Because
it's very light on the story stuff, but it has a lot of really interesting mechanics and like sandbox elements that can interact in different interesting areas you can stumble upon that I think if you are someone who knows you're going to play this game or has maybe started playing this game and isn't very deep into it, you probably would not want to hear that stuff because part of the big fun of this game is the surprise of
and the
stumbling
discovery
on these things.
And making your own stories with it, which is what it's really about to me. It's not really a spoiler to say you're going to have to kill Ganon at the end because they tell you that at the beginning.
Still got that quest in my log.
Yeah. It would be a spoiler to say what you found at Death Mountain or something. Yeah. So that's what
I
we're defining.
I know what I found. Actually, I haven't been there yet.
Yeah.
But I was going to say Death.
Then we're not going to talk about Death Mountain. But mild, weird spoilers from here on out. But we're not going to censor ourselves too much. I mean, I'll censor myself a little because I'm not going to spoil for you.
Yeah.
But Let's go ahead and talk about this game. I actually have a list of things I want to talk about with it because I've been trying to, and I'm not going to, we'll do that later, but I've been trying to think about how to make my kind of thoughts on this game even more coherent, and so I have kind of a checklist of things I'd like to talk about. But you've heard me talk about Zelda. I want to hear more thoughts from you, Sean, and kind of have some back and forth on this. So.
Okay. Yeah, this is like a hard game to talk about because there's so much stuff. I guess I'll start by just sort of like describing the general path I've taken through the game so far, because obviously...
Everyone's is different.
Yeah, everyone, you can do whatever you want. You could just, like, part of me wants to just straight up roll up on Hyrule Castle and fuck Ganon up, because I'm pretty sure I could. I'm so fucking powerful in this game, I'm pretty sure I could just ram my spear right up his fucking pork ass, take that motherfucker out right away, because, man, do I have a lot of shit. But, so basically, you know, obviously everyone starts on the Great Plateau, and I have taken what feels like is the more or less expected route of the game. Like, I've gone off the beaten path for sure, but I've, like, generally followed where the game is pointed you, because you know, you go off the Great Plateau with, like, I think you have a general quest to go find Impa at Kakariko Village. So I basically made my way there, met Impa, then they point you to Hatano Village, and I went up there and met Impa's sister up there and, like, got all that stuff. It got all, like, the runes, map, and all that shit. And then that's where I started to go, like, okay, now this is where they really kind of say, like, you can just go do whatever you want. Like, you have, like, your basic tools and you have the camera. Because that was, I think that's the thing you get there that fills in the last slot in your runes. And then that's where I kind of wandered around. I went back west and got the first Zelda cutscene that I found, which it's the one where you can see the mountains in the picture. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, I know generally where that's going to be, so I'm going to go get that. And that's where I had my fun voice acting adventure and found out if you're going to have Zelda have a British accent, maybe think about hiring a British voice actress, because that would be my first tip for your voice acting. And also... Okay, because this whole conversation is just going to keep on going off on tangents, so I might as well just go off on it when I think of one. What I think the weirdest thing to me about the voice acting in the game, which, like, depending on characters, has ranged for, like okay to, I think, kind of bad. Like, I really don't like Zelda's voice very much.
Oh, okay.
I don't like the Zora lady's voice, because I just did the Zora stuff. I don't like her
voice. Oh, those are my two favorite voices in the game. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's just both of those voices very much sound like two American voice actresses having to do a British accent because they are supposed to do a British accent, and trying to do this very, like, soft-spoken character thing that, like, Japanese voice actresses are much better at doing generally, because they have generally much higher-pitched voices, and so it's, like, a much more sort of suited role for them. And, like, it feels like the voice direction is not what it needs to be. Like, it sounds like a bad anime dub instead of them, like, trying to take the characters and, like, do whatever they need to do with it to make it sound good in English. But then my other issue with the voice acting that is more a broad thing is that it is very, very weird to me. And this, like, was especially accentuated by the Zora area, where you get voice acted characters that you interact with more readily with Prince Shinon or whatever.
Sifon or something.
It's S-I-N-O-N, so oh, however you're supposed Sinon, to pronounce yeah. that. But the weird... One of the weird things is... Shinon would be, like, the Japanese pronunciation. The reason why I would use the Japanese pronunciation is because all these characters are Japanese, because all those characters are voiced by Japanese people. They're just voicing Japanese by Japanese people, and, like, huh? Hi? Genki? Like, they, like, literally say, like, single word phrases in Japanese sometimes when you talk to them, and it's really weird to have all of these characters, like, speak either in Japanese, like a word, maybe two words at most, or, like, in, like, very clearly identifiable Japanese, like, phonemes, like, huh? And stuff like that, in a way that's like, then when you cut to English voice acting, it's like, those two things don't mesh. They really should have gone with, like, a fakey Hylian language or something. Like, and this is, like, a much higher level decision or whatever, but something where it feels, if this is not a huge complaint of the game or whatever, but it feels really weird to me sometimes to go between, like, this character having their, like, Japanese or, like, huh? voice, and then going to, like, hello, Link, it is me, the Prince of the Zoras, or whatever. You know, like, there's a really bizarre disconnect between this, like, Japanese world and then English-speaking people just sort of, like, popping up in it amongst all these other people that are clearly supposed to be speaking in, like, a Japanese-sounding language.
But I don't mind that at all. Okay. I love the little voices in the world. I'm not talking about the voice acted cutscenes, but the what you're saying, like the Japanese.
Yeah, no,
like
I think those are great.
I love that stuff.
Yeah.
And sure, they could have, I mean... I just wish the game let you play the dialogue in Japanese with like English subtitles.
That would definitely help.
But you know, whatever. I like the voice acting in this game fine. I actually like Zelda and Mipha are my two favorite voices. Some of the other ones I find less good, but it's so minimal that I don't mind. And I actually really love the way voice is used in the world itself. And I actually like the amount. I like when they choose to use voice acting, and when they that generally the game doesn't. I actually think that's an important quality of the game.
Yeah, but yeah, so like again, it's not a big deal, but it was just sort of occurred to me while I was talking about what I was talking about. But anyway, so that's where I figured out my voice acting thing. Then I went. I think I went back to Hatino Village, and then the biggest like sort of excursion, I went off the main path because you're like very clearly supposed to go to generally the Zora area because it's the closest to where you have already been, because it's like just north of Hatino. Instead of just going up there, I curved south and sort of like went around into like there's this whole jungle area with lightning and shit, and I basically cleared out that whole area.
That's one of the last things I did.
Huh.
I love this, yeah.
Yeah, and so then after doing that, that's when I looped back up, and that like this morning I was like, okay, I should probably do one of these dungeons before I do this podcast. And I'm basically at the point where I really want to do something that is more directed in this game. So then I went up and I went through the sort of... I had already been in the swamp area and I went through that. And I was like, okay, there's the Zora people. I'll go do the Zora thing. And then I did the Zora thing. And then here I am today.
Okay.
So that's... So
you've had a good taste of a lot of what the game has to offer.
Yeah, I mean, I have basically cleared out the whole, like, southeastern corner of the map. And now I feel like I can basically go anywhere. Like, if I teleport around to different shrines, I'm basically, from any point I have been, I can get to as close to any of those shrines, like, equidistant anywhere I've been on the map already. So, like, it's completely wide open to me at this point.
Yeah. Nice. So you've done a good amount of this. I mean, you said you had some frustrations, but I'm interested just to hear, because I like being positive.
Yes.
And I love this game. What are the things you find really interesting about this game and you like?
I think I like, I really love the shrines. I think the way that they have found a way to incorporate the general Zelda puzzle mechanic into a bite-sized thing that you can just, while walking around the world, you can be like, oh, hey, like, let's pop in here, do this, knock this shrine out. That's really that, because that has kind of been my main focus of like, while I am exploring around, like what I'm really trying to do is like, I want to go find another shrine, and then I will stumble upon something along the way, and that has also led to like the most interesting stuff has generally been the shrine quest that you stumble upon.
That's great.
Yeah, so like I have done, I think like for me, what it feels like the two most significant and interesting things I've done in the game were. You have a shrine quest to go up that like icy mountain by Hatino Village, and there's an ice dragon at the top of the mountain. I did that one, and then there's
that part. Oh my god!
Yeah, and then there's the Eventide Island part that is near the rainforest, and I did that.
I only just did that. And Eventide Island is one of the best things in this game. It's so good.
Yeah, it has like that whole Robinson Crusoe like castaway thing. That's pretty interesting.
It might be even more fun when you do it way later in the game, like I did. And you're so far from not having anything in the game. Like, to me, it was going back 3 weeks when my time with the game, where now I had nothing. I don't know how if it feels quite as... To me, like, it was really magical for that reason. I don't know if it would come across to that same degree when you had kind of just recently started the game.
Yeah, I mean, because I had been playing the game for probably over 10 hours by the time I had hit that. And I should also say, like, one of the ways I've been making my way in this game is... Other than after I beat that dungeon, so like right now I have 4 hearts. I have not been putting any of my upgrades into hearts
because
you don't fucking need it. You get so many healing items just by running around the world. You don't need any hearts. Like as long as you have enough armor to not get one-shotted by anything, you're fine. Just fucking put everything into stamina. I think I need 2 more upgrades and I'll have maxed out stamina. It's like
I went even for a little bit on both. Because there are parts you can stumble into where having more hearts is helpful. But, generally, and it's just because the stamina, it's so fun and it allows you to do so many things.
Yeah.
And it does kind of feel like, again, I don't think there's anything like where the game specifically wants you to do, but I do think it feels like that's kind of like the game designers would even say, like, I would probably put my stuff into heart stamina
first.
Yeah,
because it's...
The hearts are also more helpful later on.
Yes. And also, like, while I really love that you can climb on everything... If you are just normally climbing on stuff, even if you put on climbing gear, it's so slow. I just want to be able to fucking jump up everything. Just jump all the time, run all the time. I want to be fast.
You can get pretty fast.
I want my fucking stamina. Yeah, so that has been one thing I think that about my playthrough of Zelda that is probably a bit different than a lot of people's, because I suspect most people would probably want to do the health thing first, because that is the instinct I feel like when you play video games is like,
I've seen a lot of people say health. I've seen a lot of people say stamina first, but yeah. Both Thomas and I did that.
It's, you gotta go stamina. Like just hard stamina. Because again, the way that the combat sort of works in the game is that since you can just at any point in the combat pause the game and eat something in your inventory, like unless something just kills you immediately, you don't need to worry about it because you can just heal all the way back up.
There are a lot of areas though where there are a lot of things that will kill you in one hit.
Like I haven't run into that. I haven't had that. I mean, because I'm taking out fucking like Lynels and Guardians at this point, like not having any issue with it. So it's like I don't like. I'm sure like there are probably like other enemies that are like more powerful, but like where I have been past like the very beginning, where like definitely a Guardian would just like boop, kill me instantly, I've been basically fine with that stuff.
Okay.
Because again, even if you just have 1/4 of a heart, that's all you need. If you have 1/4 of a heart, you're fucking golden. You just eat fucking like 8 apples or whatever it is, and you're back in prime time, motherfucker.
Well, I mean, I'm curious to hear. I mean, how much have you been putting into like the cooking system? So you're, because if you have fewer hearts, you're probably engaging with that a lot to be ready for it.
I've cooked like the most of the, because I just did the Zora one, so I've cooked 4 times in the game. So I basically like I just grab everything I can. Like I said earlier, I just am throwing bombs at goats constantly. Fucking bison. I have left a just trail of exploded bison guts in my path on these mountaintops, because you get 2 things of meat from them that if you cook them gives you basically, I mean, even I think one of the types of meat you can get from bisons just gives you 3 stars even uncooked if you just eat it raw. And so I've just been like laying waste to nature on my path of just getting apples and bananas and stuff. And there have been a couple of times I've done the cooking. I wish I'd have a lot of sort of niggling issues with the UI stuff of like, I really wish you could just batch cook things of like, I've got like literally 80 apples in my inventory. I've like, just let me fucking cook all of them. Like they just like turn them all into baked apples or turn them into like apple stew. Like, let me just like, and like it's cool that you can do the thing and like hold them all and they all exist as like physical objects and you can dump them in the cooking pot. But at some point, like, you know, when I did a sort of big batching of cooking like halfway through my playthrough so far, which is where I have most of my healing items and buff items and stuff from still, because I haven't used that many, I literally spent like 15 to 20 minutes just cooking shit I picked up. And then now I was at the Zora area and they had a cooking pot there, and I was like, okay, I have so much stuff I haven't cooked at all. Even like all through the stuff I picked up through like the rainforest area, I hadn't cooked any of it yet. And I went to go start cooking that, and I made like 9 dishes, and then it said you can't hold any more cooked foods. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess I'm good then. Which was like, it was both a blessing and a curse. It was a blessing in that like, okay, I don't need to do any more cursing or any more cooking. It was a curse in that it's like, but I have all this stuff that, like, if I keep on eating these apples, it's not the most efficient way to eat these apples. Because if they were baked apples, they would do, like, 1.5 more healing. But, yeah, I mean, I have been doing the cooking stuff. And with the cooking, you can, it's something that, like, I feel like the system is maybe a little bit kind of broken in that you can very easily make a lot of items that make you incredibly powerful. So if you make foods that give you like high defense boost or like high damage boost, like that makes you so powerful, and you can do that again pretty easily if you know like a couple places to go.
Sure,
or like I just made a soup that can like fully heal me and give me 20 fucking hearts.
Sure. And here's the thing, like with a lot of enemies though, you get your 20 hearts, they'll take 10 of that in a hit.
Okay.
And stuff like that. I mean, there's a ton of that in this game. And for me, part of where my journey in unlocking how genius I think a lot of those systems is in stumbling into areas where it's like, oh shit, I am not prepared for this.
Okay.
And I've hit a lot of those areas. And it's funny because a lot of the areas you've been to, I went to much later. So I have, like, I cannot put myself into the same mindset
right.
of what I would have, because I don't even know quite what I would have been able to do against enemies there. Because I think that forest is lighter on stuff than, like, I've been much more to the western northern part of the map is where I did a lot of early stuff. So anyway, but like some of the best experiences are when I've been somewhere and it's like, okay, I'm not quite ready. And instead of like giving up and going somewhere else, which you could totally do, and that's totally fine, it's something I love about this game, you could also start looking at, okay, what do I have? What could I go get if I want to? What can I make and start getting all this stuff together? And I don't think it breaks the system. I think it allows for all sorts of possibilities that, like, you know, there are some parts of the game that would be a lot harder to start with than others. Like, you know, the Zora part is pretty nice to start with as one of the main four because there's not a specific condition going on.
Right.
That there's a little bit of the electricity stuff, but there's not as much of a specific condition going on. Like, this, I don't think this is a spoiler, that on Goron Mountain there's heat.
Death right, Mountain, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it's a giant volcano you can see from anywhere in the map. I'm pretty sure it's hot up there.
Yeah, and so because there are more things working against you, it would be harder to start with Death Mountain, but it would be totally possible because if you prepared and put in the work with that, you could get everything you need and you could work your way through it, and I find that really compelling. And I've gotten to a lot of areas where, like, some of the shrines have combat trials, and some of those can get really tough with some of, like, the guardians
do
they throw at you.
Because I've done probably four or five of those. Do you ever fight, like, a different kind of guardian? Not one that just is like, this is the one with the sword, this is the one with the spear, this is the one with the axe, this is the one with the sword, spear, and the axe. Like, but they all have basically the exact same attack routines. Do you ever find one of those that doesn't have one of those?
They're all very similar.
Okay.
As you go up, have you done any of, like, the major tests of strength?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, because I got a, like, Guardian Axe plus or something from that. Yeah.
Mostly they're similar. Sometimes they change conditions in the room, and there's certain things you have to account for there. Like, some of them, you know, they have their spinning attack they do, and you can, like, block it with a wall.
All of them have had, like, those pillars in the room.
Don't have pillars. Okay. Some have, like, metal things you can raise and lower. Some have none of that, and it's just you and the Guardian.
Because for me, like, again, I've done, like, five of them. I've only done one of the major ones, but, like, all of them have been, like, it's been the exact same fight every single time, and, like, I found that to be kind of disappointing, because I kept on thinking there's going to be, like, different ones. And that has kind of been something, an issue I've had with a lot of the combat in the game, is, like, you fight the, like, a lot of the same enemies again and again and again and again, and, like, they don't really change much. Of, like, you fight a lot of Bokoblins, you fight a lot of Lizalfos, you fight, like, I mean, obviously there's, like Heese and Shushus, but those aren't, like, really enemies.
Right.
And then even, like, a lot of the big enemies you fight, like, I fought a couple of the big stone dudes and a couple, like, the big... The elephant dudes, like, the one that's on Eventide Island, which I think that was the first one I had killed. Or that was actually the first time I ever fought one of those things.
That's really hard on Eventide Island, too.
No, I didn't fight. Because it's like, it's my issue with the... I think this is part of my issue with the game, and it's something that, like, maybe it's just, like, the path I have taken. But when you say, like, I've, like, run into stuff that I felt I was not prepared for, and then I was like, okay, what do I have and how do I do this? I feel like I haven't run into that. Like, on, like, Eventide Island, like... All you do is you stay a little bit close to him, and then you, like, when he goes to, like, lean into attack, you run backwards, shoot him in the eye with an arrow, and then go in and hit him, and you do that, like, three or four times, and they die. And that's, like, every single fight, and I've killed, like, 10 of those things now. Every single fight just goes like that. And it's, like, it's a little bit frustrating because I want the game to challenge me a bit more, but I feel like every single enemy I've run into has, like, 2 to 3 attacks, and they're very easy to sort of read. And then if you dodge them, you can do so much damage against them with, like, the slow motion thing.
This is a problem you have with a lot of games.
Okay, yeah.
Like, with Middle Earth, Shadow of Mordor, with Final Fantasy XV, I feel like I remember this.
That one was specifically I had just over-leveled in Final Fantasy XV.
But I hear this a lot from you that I don't hear from other people. I'm not saying that's illegitimate. Yeah. I'm saying it's a way you play games that I think most people don't.
Sure, yeah.
Because I definitely think I've heard way more what I'm saying of that this game does feel challenging.
Yeah, no, like, I've heard that too. And that's, like, that's part of the reason why I was, like, excited for that. Because also, like, because that is, like, part of the experience I got from Horizon Zero Dawn was that game was fucking hard. And, like, you had to be on your shit in the combat and, like... It was very challenging, and, like, it was very... Even if you were fighting the same enemies again, like, it would change things up in interesting ways, and I feel like that's just not, like... And not to say that, you know, this game is not as combat-centric and stuff, that you don't need to compare it to Horizon or other games necessarily, but it does feel a lot to me like I have run up... Because it's, like, the first 10 hours of the game, there was a lot of moments where I, like, ran up against an enemy where I was like, oh, like, this is a Lynel. Like, I've heard these things are hard, and then I fought it, and I was like... I died once or twice against it, but then once you, see it's, like, 2 to 3 attacks that it does, they're not that difficult. Like,
but see,
backflip and then do a flurry attack, backflip, flurry attack, backflip, flurry. Like, you can get them in, like, a loop to kill them very easily.
All I'm saying is that I think this is something that's, I think, a lot easier for you than a lot of gamers.
Sure.
Like, I can identify those patterns too, and I can see what a Lynel does. I still have a lot of difficulty because I think those patterns are, to me, inherently very challenging.
Okay.
And I think to a lot of people where, yes, I know the Lynel's going to do this, whether or not I can actually execute what I know I need to do to be able to do this certain thing I want to do, that is a harder thing, and I think that's... That might be one of the disconnects, which is basically just praising you and saying you're pretty good at video games compared to most people. But, you know.
Yeah. It took me a little bit longer to figure out how you kill those guardian things. And I mostly figured out how you take those out with the legs just because I used that, like, the guardian axe plus plus or whatever I got from that major test of strength. And that just takes out one of its legs immediately. I was like, oh, that's how you damage these things. Because those still basically one-shot me unless I use a defense booster. But other than that... Like, those are, like, the Lynel thing, I don't think, like, they're that hard. And, like, the Guardians are a little bit more challenging. But, like, I guess I was hoping that this game, like, would present more difficulties of stuff, like, I remember when I would play, or try to play, like, never really managed to get that deep into the game. But with Morrowind, like, that's a game where, like, you can go somewhere in that world, and you can run into something that's, like, nope. Like, no matter how good you are at manipulating these systems, like... You're gonna have to get more powerful. You're gonna have to like learn something a lot deeper about how like the combat or something of this game works, or how to use the magic system in this game before you can take out something like this. And I just haven't. I've heard people talking about that with Zelda, and that's just not the experience I've been having. Like even.
But I guess I'm going more in a nuanced way with this. Where I don't think there's any part that blocks you off inherently. You know, like what you're saying with Morrowind. But I think this is some of it. It's so much about what you're bringing to the table.
Right.
You happen to bring to the table, I think, a mindset and skill set with games that is very good at piercing through some of the systems they have here. You know, I bring to the table. I'm much more thinking of kind of behind the scenes strategy and stuff because I know I'm not the kind of player who can execute perfectly with instincts and reflexes all those things in the game.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that's... But getting back to, I think, the conversation we were having was just, you know, what I was saying is it is something I like about sort of all the different interacting systems in the game is that it allows you to... And whether you think it overpowers you or something, I think clearly a lot of people don't think that given how many people say there's a challenge to this game. It does allow you to say, if I want to climb that cold mountain, even though I don't have, like, a hint of, like, winter gear,
right.
I can figure out a way to do that. And that's open to you, and it's about what you put into it. And then I also have to counter, we're not in a debate, but just my viewpoint on this of like some of the things I've heard you maybe complain about, like the cooking speed and stuff like that. I have a more like grand unified theory of how I view pace in this game, but I'll save that for later. That's maybe a later discussion.
Okay.
But I generally like that it makes you slow down in a lot of ways, but that's a different discussion to have. So, I mean, so we were talking about, we've already gone on a lot of tangents.
Just again, there's so much in this game, it is really hard to sort of like... talk about like
here's where we went. I asked you to say something you liked. You said the shrines, and then we jumped into a discussion of things that I think you're more ambivalent about.
Yes.
So I don't know, what do you want to talk about next, good or bad?
There's just so much fucking shit in this game.
Do you want me to guide it a little more?
Sure. I
love the art style in this game. I love the visuals, and I just love being in this world. Do you have a similar feeling, different feeling?
Yeah, basically. I do. I have had more of an issue with the frame rate stuff than... And, like, I think the Wii U version, while it, like, does not have drastically worse frame rate issues than the Switch, it seems like it has, from what I have read with, like, the Digital Foundry report, it has somewhat worse issues. But I am having, like, more of a problem with that of, like, it has definitely popped up in combat for me multiple times of, like... Or, like, sometimes if I'm trying to jump on something and it's like, oh, like, that button press just didn't really register because the frame rate is dropping too hard.
I also definitely play a lot on the Switch, like, portable unit, which has almost no frame rate drops.
Yeah, so that would be very nice. Because I really like the art style. Although, like, I think there's sometimes the game looks a bit, like, almost kind of fuzzy to me. And I think it's part of it is, like, the compromises they need to make in order to have the draw distance they have is that, like, You have this like big sweeping like vista in front of you, but in order for it to be able to actually like technically draw that information in, like it is everything in the distance is so barren and like things are popping in front of you relative, like it's like close enough that you can really notice it. That like I think the art style is fantastic, but I think like the technical limitations of the game are definitely holding it back in ways that frustrate me a lot of the time, because there are definitely moments where, especially the stuff they do with the lighting of and the grass and stuff like that, and how light hits grass and it has this very stylized look, those look so great. But then when it's like it's raining and like the it looks very flat and it's kind of fuzzy and there's like kind of too much in like the rain like effect is maybe like a bit too much and the frame rate starts tanking. Like that's where the game starts. The game doesn't look that great to me. I think not because of the art style, but because the Wii U is not quite capable of doing what they wanted it to be able to do.
And I am curious, technical reports aside, like I mentioned, like booting up the Wii U here with yours for like 5 minutes and just looking at it because there is a difference between Wii U and Switch docked in resolution and some other things.
The Switch docked is 900p. This is 720.
And I feel some of what you're saying, but definitely a lot less. Like,
I mean, it is also part of it, I think, is just the stark contrast between coming from Horizon Zero Dawn that, like, is, and, like, the technical merits, at the very least, is certainly, like, the best looking or one of the best looking games I've ever played. And it's, like, that has such a, like, really sharp look to it that losing some of that with, like, things that are easier to point out of, like, the text and the menus and stuff like that is very noticeable comparatively of going from, like, a 1080p 30 frames per second game to a 720p 20 to 30 frames per second game.
Yeah,
It's a harsh kind of, like, backlash.
Sure, and yeah, definitely doing the Wii U version would make that even harsher.
Yeah, even worse,
position.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love the look. I mean, the art style in this game is just so fucking incredible that I think it... Definitely there are points where, you know, it will catch my eye like, oh, this is definitely a very low-res texture or something, or this looks a little fuzzy. But generally, like, I feel like the game is so good at hiding that through its art style. It's kind of, to me, it's one of the best examples of Nintendo's overall philosophy on this stuff of art style over technical merits. And there are definitely points where if the Wii U were a more powerful console, there's more things they could push with it. That the Switch holds up well enough with what is a game that was built for the bones of the Wii U. I'm really interested to see what the Switch can do with like later games and
sure,
stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like, but any. I mean, that's getting into a different discussion. But
I mean, I will have to say, for me, on like just a technical side, I think the most impressive thing about the game is the foliage. Like the fact that there is like so much grass and like blowing bushes and stuff
that
on screen,
beautiful.
On something that is like as like relatively weak as the Wii U is. Kind of insane to me when you think about that. Like this thing is only like marginally better than a 360 or PS3, and like this looks way better than any of the games on those consoles for sure.
Oh, I mean, the game is definitely a technical marvel.
Yeah,
even with its problems, like its problems are.
I mean, yeah, because you have
that.
Yeah, you have to sort of take into account the platform it's made on. It obviously, if the game had been designed for like the PC or the PS4, it would look like way better on a technical way, but. You take into account that it's on the Wii U and the Switch, it's like,
The same time, this is something that's wonderful about the art style, is there are some things that would look the way they look, because that's they've done, and that's what they've made, and, you know, I think some of those, having that draw distance is just one of those things that keeps it exciting, of like, I so constantly, whether I'm playing on my 6-inch Switch screen or on my 40-inch TV, I see a little thing in the distance, and I'm like, that's something I want to go see. And I'll go there and I find something interesting and fun and exciting. And, you know, whether that's a Korok seed or something else, there's so many cool things.
There's so many Korok seeds in this game.
There's so many Korok seeds.
I've kind of, like, I have had parts of this game where I'm like, I know that that's a Korok seed over there. I'm not going to get it. I'm just going to walk by this. Because I haven't fucking seen the dude who I can trade the Korok seeds for the inventory in a long time now. Like, I ran into him twice, and then I haven't seen him. I have no idea where he is. It's like, I'll get these Korok seeds later.
But, like, I have a whole, like, I tweeted this once kind of as a joke, but, like, I think there's something to me about the Korok seeds, which I have not talked about on this podcast yet.
Okay.
That's one thing about the game I haven't talked about, that I think to me is so representative of some of the things this game does so beautifully and well, which is that the Korok seeds are, you know, technically this big sort of quote-unquote collectible in the game. There's a lot of them, they're all over the place, but it's done so differently than any other open-world game I've ever seen where they're not a thing on your map. They're not even a thing with an indicator. The game is not by any means pressuring you to get them all. The only reason we know there are 900 is because that's in like a guide or something.
Yeah.
It's not the game telling you there are 900 or that you need to get 900. And actually, if you look at it, to upgrade all your inventory, you don't need anywhere near 900. Like, they're there for you to discover while you're playing.
Yeah.
And what's wonderful about them is that there's just these natural patterns in the world that ask you to notice them and engage with them, but there's no official tutorialization about it. There's no formal exposition about it whatsoever. It's just, you notice at one point, like, hey, there are consistently rocks on high peaks. And if I climb this, I'll probably find a Korok under that rock.
Yeah.
Or there is consistently, I might see a circle of rocks. Oh, why is there a rock missing here? I find, there's a Korok. And, like, even to this, like, I am probably, you know, 60-some hours into this game more. I have no idea what the actual count is. But I've been playing it as much as I can over 3 weeks. And I'm still finding new ways to find Koroks. And I love that about the game. That the game, that is something that is actively asking for and rewarding your curiosity in the world. And I think that represents how the game does the shrines and the puzzles within the shrines, how it does the puzzles within the quote-unquote dungeons, which are really not traditional Zelda dungeons, yeah. But the divine beasts. Just the general sense of exploration is it's a game that everything you need to know is translated or is transmitted to you through the world itself. And the Koroks are like this wonderful slice of that. And, you know, I often just have the opposite of you, where instead of not getting a Korok, it'll be like, I see something, and then I just, like, decide, I just want to be in the world for the next 30 minutes, and I want to explore, and I'll ostensibly look for Koroks, which just means I'm going to look around the world, and if I find interesting things, I'll go after it, and usually that will be rewarded with the Koroks. And that does have, it branches and connects to another system, which is your inventory management, and it does have a very tangible reward in that you get to expand your inventory slots and stuff like that. But it's also
you'll never have enough inventory slots. You will always be full on everything, except for shields and bows, because I don't want to open a chest and have it close on me, because and then have to go in my inventory and drop a shield or bow. It's just a step too far. I don't need to carry six shields and bows on me at any given time. I'll only have five.
Sure, no. But you know what I mean, like, with all of this, like, that's something I really, and the more I play the game, the more, because early on the Koroks can feel more like a distraction because there's so many things to discover and you're still learning about systems in the game. I'm at a different point and it's just something I love, kind of. Just it's something that pushes me through exploring and being curious about the world.
Yeah, like, and I basically agree with that, although I'm having, this is like something that is sort of, and I'm curious to see if this is going to change now that I've finished a dungeon and going out to, like, hopefully, like, even more different areas. But I think the biggest issue I've been having with the game is the thing that has, like, really, like, you know, like, me being, like, feeling overpowered in some places and stuff like that. Like, that's not that big of a deal because I'm still, like, it doesn't really impact my active enjoyment. It means that, like, I'm not, I feel like there's a more fun version of this game that exists that I wish I was, like, could access by, like, there being a harder difficulty or something like that. But it's not a big issue. For me, the biggest issue I've been having with this game that sometimes leaves me just feeling kind of really bored and it kind of feels tedious sometimes is, while it does, like, it has, like, Korok seeds and little, like, chests and shrines all over the place that reward you constantly for going off the beaten path, like, I'm starting to feel like those rewards are not very satisfying for me. Of, like, and I think a lot of it ties into the way they handle equipment in this game, and that there's a lot of stuff that I think works very well because, you know, you move through shields and bows and swords, so particularly like your melee weapons, so quickly, and so you're constantly in a need of just, like, picking up more and more and more and more and more of them, because you're just going to keep on breaking them the more you engage with the combat system. And I think that there's a lot of merit to that, and it does something for allowing you to have fun moments of being able to, like, you know, throw your half-broken sword at a bokoblin in the face and pick up his club and kill him with his club. That stuff is cool. But at the same time, making the gear be something that, other than the clothing, which is something you get very, very rarely.
All you get more as you play, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because I've just got, like, the Zora suit and stuff like that. But you don't, like, I have found it in, like, I've found pieces of gear in a couple of places. Like, I have, like, some rubber suit stuff that I got in the lightning place. I have some climbing gear stuff I found in shrines. But in general, you very rarely find gear just exploring the world. But you find, like, spears and swords and axes and all that stuff constantly. But I think the issue is, those things are not very exciting for me to get, because it basically feels like you're giving me a rocket launcher. You're like a sword is ammunition in this game because it is so temporary. And so it's like, oh, well, this is like a stronger sword. I'll use this to kill a guardian whenever, if I ever get in a fight with one of those things again. But it's something that And then also, like, you know, the Korok seeds are so plentiful. And again, like, I just haven't seen the dude that I can give my Korok seeds in such a long time. I kind of forget sometimes that there's, like, a further purpose for them other than just collecting them. And then the shrines, which are definitely the most rewarding because those give you a permanent upgrade. But you have to do four of them before you get that permanent upgrade. And there's no sort of, like, overall leveling system or anything like that in the game. I'm just finding, like, the sense of sort of, like, the progression mechanics in the game just feel slightly lacking of, like, I just don't get excited when I find a weapon anymore. Because it's just, like, you know, it's so temporary to me. It's so just sort of transient. Like, it feels like this weird almost, like, Buddhist Zen state of, like, I have a spear, I don't have a spear. It is the same thing to me.
And I love that about the game. And this is something that's interesting to me. I'm actually mildly surprised that reaction is not more split on this game.
Yeah.
And obviously, you would be giving this a positive review, right?
Like, oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
Recommendation, all that stuff.
Yes.
And I'm not saying I'm not surprised there's not, like, flaming negative reviews. No. That would be a dumb review, frankly. But, and I don't think there have been any of those, right?
No.
But I'm surprised there aren't more people saying sort of what you're saying, because I think the game is going for something very specific. And the more specific you go for something, the less it, you know, just a general thing of art, right?
Yes.
And I think, for me, the greatest reward of any reward system in the game is being in the game.
Okay.
And it is this transient thing of, yes, I want what is in that chest because it might be something I really enjoy using. But what do I really want to get out of that chest? I want to do whatever the process is that gets me to get that chest. And it's just, I enjoy the basic mechanics of the game so much. I enjoy being in the world so much. I find it so relaxing. I find it so weirdly transcendental in some ways, that to me, it's like, what it is it's just being in the world, and you get some of the rewards are physical progression things, and some of the rewards are just getting to do it and getting to see it and getting to experience it. And that's actually one of the things that I feel is the most Zelda-esque things about this game, which is that for me, like, when I played A Link to the Past or Link's Awakening, I 100% those games, and it's not necessarily because I feel like I need every single heart to beat the final boss. I probably don't. Obviously, many people have done it. But it's because I want to see what thing happens over there, or I want to see what corner of the map I unveil, or I want to do the puzzle, or like in a dungeon in like Link to the Past, let's say, there are plenty of rooms you don't need to go to that'll have a rupee in them or an arrow or something, and that'll be nice to have. It'll obviously help me in the long run, but to me, the real reward for going there is I want to see that dungeon room, and I want to see what they've built, because I find the game design so fascinating, and I find it so engaging on so many levels. And with Breath of the Wild, I think it's that, in that you have the puzzles and doing the Korok things and just interacting with the world I love. But then there's that larger level of, because it's this open world game, and I find it so beautiful, and I love kind of the peace and quiet of it, and I love the slow pace, and I love that it kind of makes me slow down and be with it and be in the moment a little bit. All of that kind of combines to that. The progression system, to me, is secondary to just existing in the world and all those things. So, you know, that's kind of one of my unified theories around this game.
For me, like, because that is definitely, like, the most fun I've had is just those kinds of moments. But I am finding, like, it's something that, and even doing the Zora dungeon thing has not, like, totally alleviated it for me. It's, like, I do feel there's like kind of a piece of this game that feels like it's missing, in that there's like everything you run into this game, like it's something you clear through in like 5 to 30 minutes. If like 30 minutes, if it's like, I mean, even 30 minutes is not really, like, that's if you get stuck somewhere or something weird like that, or like you get stuck in a rainstorm so you can't climb up this hill. But like most of the things you encounter in this game, I'm just like floating across the top of this game. It's like, oh, it's a Korok seed, blah, 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 done. It's a shrine, go in, solve one puzzle, maybe two puzzles, done. Like, this, like, it's a camp of enemies, there's three enemies in there, blah, 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 done. Like, it's a lot of stuff of like, there's a lot of activities in the game that you just clear through so quickly and so sort of, like, easily. And I do find myself, like every once in a while I'll get something that does feel a little bit more substantive, like the Eventide Island, like that mountain, and then obviously the Zora dungeon is one of those. But I do find myself missing something that is other open world games kind of like this, of like a Skyrim or something. I'm missing that element of being able to like stumble upon, like, oh, there's like this whole underground cave system here or something that's like, I go in and like it's the, and it like, it would for like this, it would have like a much more elaborate puzzles, like sort of construction, and the, like more intensive like enemy encounters, and a big reward at the end, and something that's, you're not even like, is not necessarily indicated, or like maybe there's a piece of dialogue that indicates that it's out there in the world and you stumble upon it. Like I said, like there's a couple of things that are kind of like that, but there's not a lot, or at least if there is more of that stuff, I haven't really found it. And I do feel like wanting that experience also of just being able to have this more sort of like satisfying, like more gameplay intensive sort of stretch of the game, of being able to just sort of like do something in the game and feel like it has been this like full satisfying experience, instead of my experience of playing Zelda is much more like, it's almost like eating potato chips or something. Like, you can just keep on doing it, just keep on doing it, just keep on doing it, because it's just this little breadcrumb trails of small objectives that you can complete very quickly and easily. And there are moments where that's very good. But the most negative moments I've had with the game are those moments where, like, I have ended up spending, like, 2 more hours playing the game than I wanted to because I kept on getting led, like, by this breadcrumb trail. And it's not, like, this really fun, like playing Civilization or something like that of, like, oh, like, the time has just melted away because I was so focused and engaged on this thing. For me, it's more of this, like, I kind of want to stop playing, but there's, like, this psychological breadcrumb thing of, like, oh, I can just see what's over that hill. I can just see what's over that hill. But for me, 90% of the time, what's over that hill is, like, kind of the same thing that was over the last hill. It's a Koroxi puzzle. It's a shrine. And most of the shrine puzzles are not, like, that extraordinarily different. All the shrines look the exact same at the very least. And it's that kind of stuff of, like, I want something that I can have, like, in The Witcher 3 or something where you finish a big quest line and feel like, I have to stop playing this game right now because, like, I have to walk away from it to process this. Or, like, it's kind of harder to come up with, like, big gameplay intensive open world games, but or like something like Horizon Zero Dawn, where it's like, oh, I just like won this fight where I fought like a storm bird and then stumbled into a nest of thunder moths and killed 2 thunder moths. I have to put this game down for a second because I'm like hyped up on adrenaline. And I kind of just wish you had more of that sense of pacing sometimes with Zelda, where you had something that was either more story intensive or more gameplay intensive to sort of punctuate these moments of sort of like the light breeziness that I feel like the game has basically throughout.
But see, this is the perspective thing I'm talking about. Because I couldn't want that any less, in a weird way, with this. But this is, and I completely predicted that was going to be your view on this. Just because I know you and I know how you look at games, and that's I kind of thought, Sean's going to like this, but I think he's going to have that issue with it. And I don't have that issue, and to me it's like, I mean, you talk about, you know, kind of breezing across the top. To me it's you know, it's just droplets forming a lake. It's, to me, it's those, that is the depth, and that is the density to me, and that, you know, I love that, you know, my big experiences where I have an hour-long chunk of the game and I feel like I did something big with it, it's not because I found a cave or I found a quest line or anything like that, and I went through it to whatever its linear end is. It's because I picked something or I tried to go do something and it turned into, like, you know, I'm going to climb this mountain or I'm going to go over this mountain range. And you know, one of the most magical evenings I had playing this was I went off into the west and I was just trying to find this one shrine I'd seen. And that turned into finding several shrines, and it turned into finding this tower and kind of exploring this area and deciding I was going to climb this mountain I in no way had the stamina for, but I figured out a way to do it anyway. And I found the Rito village and I kind of put it aside for that night because I felt like, wow, that was a hell of an adventure. And it was so, to me, self-motivated and not at all scripted within the world of the game. And those things are so utterly magical to me because I do sometimes push against linearity in games. And I don't mean linearity in terms of like Persona where you kind of go, that just is a linear game. There's no there's no other mode of that game. Where, you know, or most RPGs are like that, or JRPGs, where, you know, that's a progressive story. But sometimes, you know, if I grew up playing platformers and I grew up playing, you know, like Mario 64 and things like that, there's something about that where even if it's linear, sort of the focus on atmosphere over story or gameplay over these things, just to me, that's one of the fundamental things gaming is just moving through a world and being with it and kind of making what you will of it. And it's something I think Breath of the Wild, to me, nails so fundamentally through those systems. But that does become a perspective thing, and I think that's what makes this an interesting conversation to have. And again, why I'm surprised, maybe, and I've seen a couple people kind of voice what you're saying, but not a lot, obviously. And I do think it's a perspective thing of that's, it's offering, I think, something very specific, and that means that it's going to appeal to people in different ways and on different levels and to different degrees.
Yeah, like, and I definitely see that, but then at the same time, because, like, because that is, like, what you're describing is more or less how I played Skyrim, honestly, or, and, like, the other Elder Scrolls games and the Bethesda games as well, because I think they are also built in a lot of ways to support that. But to me, there's, like, a sort of magic in a game like that of being able to, or even like The Witcher 3, just because it's even more recent. It doesn't support it quite as well as Skyrim. But like one of the most memorable things I had with Witcher 3 when I first started playing it is, you know, in the first area in White Orchard, you can get that Witcher contract for the Noonwraith. And it's this whole small story around like this little tiny like 3-house hamlet or whatever off to the side where all the people are dead. And one of the women that lived there has been resurrected and like is haunting the place as Noonwraith, and you're contracted to go take out and exorcise that Noonwraith effectively. But when I played that game, I did not approach that because I got a Witcher contract. I just stumbled into that town while I was wandering around the world. I didn't even know that quest existed. And I just entered this town where everyone was dead and just, like, started snooping around and reading letters and, like, was able to piece together this story. And, like, that quest sort of supported this design of, like, I had no idea that this even existed. I just walked into this town and was so sort of captured by the mystery of what happened here that I solved that mystery. And then, like, there's, like, a point where it sort of, like, locks back into the quest sort of thing at the very end where you get, like, where you find out who you need to go talk to and get your reward if you had gotten the quest the normal way. And, like, I think there's a lot of things like that that, like, I just kind of wish it had something like that you could stumble into something that felt more unique. Because for so much of Zelda, it feels like, while the landscape is very fascinating, like, I keep on running into camps of Bokoblins. I keep on running into camps of Lizalfos. And, like, the things I'm doing in the world feel like they are, like, that I'm doing right now are the same things I have been doing for basically the whole time.
But I feel that to certain degrees with Witcher and Skyrim and things like that, because what you're describing are moments of more concrete narrativization, where you stumbled upon it in an interesting way, but the linear story that is told through that is going to be the narrative
kind of
experience.
But the way and that you piece together that story is your own.
Sure.
Like but the way you, how I picked up those notes and interpreted those notes and sort of, like, figured out what this is, especially by not having been railroaded into the quest from the beginning. And there are, like, other instances of that in Witcher and fucking hundreds of them in Skyrim.
Sure.
Like, it is a, like, unique experience of, like, oh, like, this is the way I stumbled into this and my experience of exploring this and discovering this is completely my own.
But it still, to me, comes back to a certain level of concrete narrativization that I don't necessarily, that I chafe against sometimes in modern games. And I think one of the things I love about Zelda is how little of that there is in there, and what is in there feels meaty to me and interesting. But it's not by any means the main thrust of the game, and I love that about it. And it's something that I often play games today where I wish, like, if you look at it, I think if I were to make a list of, like, or I've made a list in the past of, like, my favorite video games, there's generally a pretty even split for me on games that tackle narrative in these fascinating, wonderful, amazing ways, and ones that more or less don't have it.
Yeah.
And I kind of go in those two directions, but I think sometimes games that maybe straddle that line more, like a Skyrim, sometimes I love it and sometimes I chafe against that. So, but I think there are two different modes of what you define as freedom in gaming. Because ultimately there's no such thing.
No.
If we go back to the Stanley Parable or something, right?
Yes.
But I don't know. I mean, it's an experiential thing at some point that speaks to also what a fascinating moment we are in for video games. That,
yeah.
I think, you know, Witcher 3 and Zelda Breath of the Wild couldn't be that much more different, and yet they're really easy to compare and contrast.
Yeah.
Strengths and weaknesses and things like that. Because they're approaching just the basic question of what a video game is and how we interact with it from such different vantage points, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it is something where I just really wish that Zelda had, again, like, more enemies or more something to, like, I feel like to fuel those moments you're describing, because I've heard so many people talk about having those kinds of moments with Zelda, and I just feel like I've had a couple of things that were more interesting of, like, the first time I fought a Lynel was at, like, there's, like, a Colosseum thing in Hyrule Field where there's one of them in there. And that was kind of a cool experience because that was the first time I'd ever seen one. And it was, like, a cool arena. Like, unfortunately, you don't really get much for doing that. Like, you get, like, 100 rupees or something that a guy gives you.
You get the experience. That's, like, honestly, that's what I say about
all of it. I get the experience. But, like, if I'm looking for that, like, something like Dark Souls gives me that so much more, like, in your fucking veins, because you get the experience of, like, discovering this thing and, like, having to understand how it works and, like, engaging with the mechanics of, like, fighting the Lynel was kind of interesting, but, like, again, obviously this is, like, so different for everybody, but I just found its attack patterns, like, so easy to read after, like, the first time it killed me that I was like, oh, okay, killed it. And it's like, well, what else is here? And it's like, there's, like, a chest at the very top that had an opal, and then I talked to a dude and he gave me some rupees. It's like, okay, like, but there wasn't anything grand to discover. It was like, there was this one enemy type I hadn't fought before, and I killed him, and now I fought, like, three or four more of those, and they have all been the same, except for one of them had a spear, and so his attack was slightly different. I feel like that's, like, what's been frustrating me with the game is I feel like there is this theoretical, endless, boundless realm of adventure, and the terrain is so fascinating. It's so fun to sort of, like, walk around, but the stuff that actually fills it is so limited. Of, like, It's red bokoblins, then blue bokoblins, then black bokoblins, and those bokoblins will either have a club and a shield, just a club. I know none of them have big clubs. Some of them have spears. All the weapons are...
Oh, they have big clubs.
Well, I think the moblins have the big clubs. But that also goes to, there are three weapon types in the game, really. You can get some, fire rods. There are a couple of, special things. But in general, you have spears, heavy weapons, and, light weapons. And heavy weapons can be just, a big hammer. It can be a big club. It can be a sword. But they all function basically the same way. I think there are a couple of enemies that kind of are more effective with blunt damage, but not... like the rock dudes, basically. And so every single enemy type you run into is going to be that enemy, maybe that enemy that is like the normal enemy, blue enemy, or black enemy, and then also it will have one of these three variations of weapons. And that's it. And I feel like I have run into so many of this is another Bokoblin, this is another Lizalfos, this is another, Lynels are more rare, but even then, they're not different. Or with all those combat ones, or the combat shrines, it is the same enemy that has a different weapon which gives them one to two different attacks. And that has been the thing that's been frustrating to me, is that I love exploring the world. I'm just finding that the things I find in it are the same no matter where I go. And that's been really frustrating.
I guess my only counterpoint would be, I feel like you could do that breakdown with just about any game ever made.
I mean, that's true, but this game is so big and vast that I think it exacerbates the problem tremendously, because it's something that it runs counter to sort of what its core philosophy needs to be, and it's something that other games are able to solve that issue by having maybe heavier narrativization, or having a loot grind, or having something that disguises that or helps it or massages it. I feel like Zelda doesn't have much of something to compensate for the sameness for me.
If you're coming at it from a certain perspective, I think.
Sure, yeah. I mean, but that is also true of anything, depending on whatever perspective you're coming at it from.
So, yeah. Anyway, let's go back. What are other things you like about this game? Because I'm sure there's things we haven't touched on.
I like the writing generally across the board.
I want to talk about that. That's one of the things on my list. So here, let's go down some of the things on my list, because I made a list of three things I wanted to talk about today with this, that I was just trying to think of, the last two times I've talked about Zelda, we've gone off on a lot of tangents and things like that, and there's so many things. But I wanted to try to zero in on some of these things, and so I was trying to list things I wanted to talk about specifically, and at the top of it was the writing. Yeah. So I want to talk about that. Because it's something that I actually think has been getting, it's underpraised in recent Nintendo games. One of the best ones being Paper Mario Color Splash that I talked about recently, or last year, with just the writing in that game is so funny and light on its feet. And I think Breath of the Wild has a similar quality to it, where everyone you run into, everyone you talk to, and I think part of it is because it's through text, they're able to do things with writing that I don't think you could do the same mode if it was all voice acted. It's light and it's clever, and just the way people have with words, there's just such a voice coming across through this game. And I love that. It does not sound generic or quite like anything else. And I like that about it. And I'm still, many hours into this game, finding new and different voices in there that I will laugh at, or I will just think that's an interesting turn of phrase. I just generally find the writing very good. And of course, you can't just praise the people in Japan who wrote it, but also the localization teams who are really good. I've always been with Nintendo, but...
Yeah, with the localization thing, just that, because I'm just thinking about it, because I just did the Zora, there's actually a really funny... If you're someone who knows English and Japanese, there's a really funny line in there where you talk to one of the Zora guards after you solved that dungeon. And he's apparently someone that Link knew 100 years ago. And he says the password is big white fluffy clouds and a wide blue. And then you're given the one option of Zora, which is, it's a Japanese pun on the word Sora, which is sky. But they just, I love the fact that they didn't bother to be fuck it. It would be insane for us to try to come up with some weird pun that would work this. This is just fine. Just leave it as is. And I thought it was really funny when I saw that. I was oh, okay.
Also, while Link is largely a cipher in this game for you, and he's, you could make the argument as you can in other Zelda games that he's not really the main character. It's Zelda, and you're seeing her story through him. Yeah. He has a great deal of personality through the responses have.
They have that core sort of persona thing going on.
He's a smartass.
Yeah, of characterizing him based on giving you these responses, which are not just a default way of yes, no. It's, there are a lot of responses that have a lot of ellipses in Link's dialogue. Yep. Or he definitely can be a bit of a smartass.
The one of the best ones, and you have seen this, so I can spoil it, is in Hateno Village when you go up to talk to Impa's sister,
yeah.
who can do the upgrades for you with yes. the ancient gear stuff. Yeah, she'll say like, give us a snap. Give us a snap. And you can say, snap!
Exclamation point. Or snap question mark.
And that's how they distinguish between
yeah.
you're going to do it or you're going to ask about it, which is a very common mechanic this and many other games have to go through.
Yeah.
And it's hilarious. It's just a great little bit there. Yeah. If you're going to go for it or you're going to say, snap? yeah. It's yes. great.
Yeah, like, it is very funny. It is, like, the dialogue is very colorful. Like, and it's, like, no matter, like, they make it so that no matter who you run into, they, like, there's something weird about them. There's something quirky. And not in a way that feels like they're trying too hard to make every character feel quirky, but just, like, everyone you run into is just a slightly, like, even the most random person is memorable in some way. They have something about them that distinguishes them from every other character in the game. And that does a lot to sort of, like, especially when you come into a village for the first time, being like, okay, like, I'm gonna walk around and just talk to everybody and see what everyone's deal is. Like, that was one of my favorite things about coming into Zora's Domain, was just being like, great, like, I want to talk to all these weird fish people and find out what they're like. And apparently, in the Japanese version of this game, there must be something going on with the polite language, because they keep on talking about how older people speak in more polite language. And again, it's just like, there's no way to translate this, fuck it.
Yeah, but, I mean, everyone, there's so much character to it. There's yeah. so, like, the characters, and again, it's light. This is not a narrative-heavy game, necessarily,
no.
but, you know, when you meet Prince Sidon or some of the other characters around there, like, their characters come across so powerfully, they're poignant, but I just mean, like, they're really interesting, fun characters to have around, and, like, the Zora one, especially, once you get through all of that, I just felt so warm inside leaving Zora's Domain and, like,
yeah.
having had this experience, because they feel like a real community there, and it's a really fun, just, as I say, nimble, light on its feet touch to the writing that allows it to do all of that.
Yeah, like, it would be very easy for there to be a version of this game that existed that had, like, all those characters feeling very bland and existed to give you, like, a quest or, like, some specific piece of information. But, you know, I love that for a lot of them. Like, you'll talk to someone that is going to give you some piece of pertinent information, but you have to, like, dig through, like, three prompts of, like, different dialogue things to get to the point where they're, like, to push them to the point where they're like, okay, fine, I'll tell you about this fucking thing. And that's, like, there's just a lot of very smart touches where they didn't just pick the easy road to go just because it's not a narrative-heavy game. They said, like, just because it's not a narrative-heavy game doesn't mean that the narrative that is there is not important.
No, I think the narrative that is there actually is often really good for what it is. And we can talk about that more. We can talk about that now. This seems like a natural transition. But one other thing I was going to say is that, so you've done like the Zora corner of the world, and I actually love that there's more to the world beyond the four, like, the Divine Beast and those communities corners.
Yeah.
That there are whole parts of the map that don't have one of those. They're there to exist and
or they
and
have supplement a dope giant flying lightning dragon or something.
Yeah, fuck those fucking dragons. So cool. Anyway, but like, you know, you've seen the Zora one. Not a spoiler to say that, like, you know, you've also got the Gorons and the Rito and the Gerudo, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's not a spoiler to say that there are certain, you know, structural things that have to repeat there because of what the game is.
Sure,
and
yeah.
All games do that. But within each of those, like, those communities feel so unique. The Gorons, who have always been, like, the most fleshed out, probably, of the Zelda, like, races, at least in the 3D games.
Sure.
Just feel so fresh and how they characterize them. And it's, like, it's just, it's, with each of these communities you meet and go to, it's just, there's so much you get out of that. That is this tangible thing that is so much through the writing, and I love that about it. So,
yeah.
And also through art direction and things, because, you know, we've never the closest we've had to seeing that much of, like, the Zoras is probably in Majora's Mask, where there's the, like, the rock concerts and that stuff.
Right.
But, Jesus. Like, which is, the Zoras have always been great, but, like, having the full Zora's Domain and all that, like, some of the art direction there, too, and the music and things like that, there's just such a great sense of culture and community to those places.
Yeah, I love, there's such little tiny bits of sort of characterization they do of, or like lore building of, I like that they basically, the Zoras are like this really long-lived species, and there's one of the Zora girls that is there that she has a side quest I haven't followed up on yet, but just like she's talking about how like, oh, it's great for you Hylians because you grow up so quickly, like she's like 40 years old or something and is still like looks like a little girl because she hasn't hit her like Zora growth spurt yet.
Yep.
And it's just little tiny bits of detail like that that's like, it goes a long way to making it feel more colorful.
And I generally think the narrative in this game is built on the micro, and I think very self-reflexively is. You know, one of the interesting mechanics is that how the brunt of the story between Link and Zelda is told is through the memories. And I actually really like this mechanic. I think it's, so you're basically, you get this camera and it has 12 pictures Zelda took on it. And you have to find the place in the world where that picture is, which, playing this so closely after Gravity Rush 2, I was like, this is the second game this year where you have to look for where pictures were taken.
There's some weird thing of, like, every such fucking video game in the world has to have a selfie mode in it now, or something. It's kind of disturbing.
It's a wonderful trend to have. But anyway, until we get it in a really bad game, I don't know. But it would be really out of place in Mass Effect Andromeda, where they just have cross-eyed Ryder.
You just go over it and you investigate this dead alien body, and like Ryder's just like taking a selfie in the background. That's
colonialism.
Like,
no.
First contact with alien species.
Yeah. But, you know, so like when I say it's built on the micro, those little moments, it's the game does not narrativize like what was the entire history of Zelda and Link. What was the specific chain of events that led to Calamity Ganon and what they did and all those things.
Yeah, because also, like, inherently to how you're discovering those memories is you're discovering them out of order. Yep. Like, it would be bizarre if you intentionally tried to, like, it would be completely unnatural to try to, like, tackle the pictures in an order.
Yeah, and even though I believe there is a sort of chronology to how the memories are, they're not meant, quote-unquote, to be watched in any order. They're meant to be uncovered as you uncover them. And that's great. And so those scenes are just these beautiful little scenes that are, as something else on my list, are filled more with quiet than they are with dialogue or noise or anything. And they're just little impressions of the relationship these two had. And little impressions of what Zelda was like and what Link was like and what they kind of got from each other. And but they remind you periodically as you're playing of kind of what you're fighting for and what's there. And give just this little like emotional tie to things that I think is really beautiful and is very unconventional. And then also I think is an interesting game mechanic where I remember when I saw that, I'm like, oh man, I'm definitely going to have to look up a guide for some of these. And you don't. Like, it's really interesting how well those pictures and all of that, they telegraph a lot of information once you know what to look for.
And they do have, there's that one, like, painter character in the world that will, like, help point you in a more specific direction that you're having. Because there's, like, Picanto. One of the pictures that I got the other day, earlier today, I found the spot where it is. Is the one that is just like, it's just in a forest, and that was the one looking at that was like, there are 500 forests in this world, and I ran into him at a stable and was like, oh, it's by the bottomless swamp. I was like, oh, great, sure. Like, I can figure out where any of these other ones, even having not been to the areas, I can look at it and be like, ah, that's probably the Gerudo area somewhere. Right. But like, that was the one I was like, I'm never going to find this.
But it does, like, they give you the tools for it. Yeah. You know, whether it's through Picango, the painter, or whether it's just on your own or something. And, like, you also kind of learn with it that at first I was kind of looking in more off-the-beaten-path locations until I realized that's not, they didn't, like, bury them in a random place on the map generally. Yeah. Like, they're not, like, on a far corner on an island you don't know you can sail to or something like that. Even that forest one, once you get there, it's like, okay, I see, like, this is more central than I thought.
Yeah, I mean, because also, yeah, if you were going through it in one direction, like, that is, like, the most natural path to take it to one's part of the map, so you would, like, just go through it anyways.
Yeah. And generally, I think those are very nice scenes. I generally like, let's put voice acting aside for a second, but I really like the direction of the cutscenes and how they're done in that they're actually a very natural extension, I think, of how the 3D Zeldas have always done and approached cutscenes, which is, again, they're more through silence and mood and atmosphere than they are just words and narrative and things like that. Until maybe you get to things like Twilight Princess, where they're narrativizing so much it becomes clunky.
Yeah, and there where it just became like a thing where they so desperately needed voice acting just for the pacing of the cutscenes, because having to pace the cutscenes for text was so awkward.
Yeah, and whether you like the quality of voice acting or not, the presence of voice acting does allow them to do things with this cutscenes they couldn't have done before.
Definitely.
Like the entire arc of the Mipha character, who is the Zora champion, and her relationship with Link, that is told through these little lines she has, and there's these little suggestions of, it's not ever made explicit what their thing was. You have to put it together through the mood of that scene, just like it very much reminded me of the Saria scenes in Ocarina of Time, and a really good expansion of that for, you know, what we can do now with the game. And I think those scenes can be really beautiful, and I actually really love the characterization of Zelda in this game.
I've only seen like three of those memories. I haven't gotten that much of it. Like, it seems fine, but I just don't have a good picture of who she is.
I just think she's interesting. I think she's, you know, a character who seems like, you know, someone who kind of is wearing the weight of the world on her shoulders, like for the first time, not for the first time, but for substantively, she's a princess, not because that's a trope, but like she's a princess and it's a job.
Right.
And like she feels like she has a duty, and she's someone who is almost a mentor figure to Link in some ways, where, I mean, have you seen the one with the flowers?
No.
Is that the one? Okay, because you said mountain, and so I'm sorry. Anyway.
No, I found the one that's like the mountains that are split in half are in the background.
Okay, that one, yeah. Yeah, I forget what's going on in that scene, but, you know, there's different scenes where she's just telling Link about things, or, you know, they exchange smaller moments, or you also see how she chafes against Link and how, where she does view him as useful. It's by the end, it paints a really interesting picture of that character and seeds some things about her where I asked Thomas, because he's finished the game, I said, does this specific thing pay off at the end? Because I so wanted to. And he said, yes, and it's beautiful. And it's just things like that where it's like, also knowing that it's building to things, that, you know, obviously the plot is that she's stuck in Hyrule Castle holding back Ganon, and that's something that they're promising you narratively, yeah. Right? And so I'm excited to see that. And it also, but it means those memories are a gameplay mechanic that are a very tangible connection to what you're doing, and they matter in so many ways to how you, if you're going to play the game, you would not, unless you're doing like a speed run, it wouldn't be very fulfilling to just jump to Hyrule Castle and not have done that stuff.
Yeah.
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 Like, so,
although, like, a part of me still wants to just, like, get close up to Hyrule Castle and just make a save and just see. It's like, I've got, like, 10 steak soups that all give me 20 hearts, and, like, I've got 5 things that give me 5, like, could I just do it?
I absolutely, when I am done with this game, I want to go back and do, like, a clean playthrough and just, my goal is just to get to Hyrule Castle and just see what I can do.
Because part of me really wants to do it right now, but I'm really afraid if I do it and I actually am able to beat Ganon with, like, I'm sure it would not be, like, on first try, but, like, if I get close enough, it's like, I probably legitimately could just straight up do this right now. I feel like it would break the rest of the game for me if I could just beat it like that.
Well, sure. But it's this fascinating thing that most games don't invite this, where it's part of the genius of the game is defeat Ganon, you get it right away. And everything else is what you make of it until you get there.
Yeah. I really hope that, in a lot of ways, I really hope the next Elder Scrolls game, like, pays attention to things that Zelda does, because it would be so amazing if, like, I wish if Skyrim had, like, started with, like, you would leave that thing and it was like, go kill that fucking dragon somehow. Like, if that was the one quest they gave you and that was, like, the main quest line and it was structured more like this, obviously it would be way more heavily narrativized than Zelda, but, like, had that, like, I think that's such a good idea for how to structure the world.
It would play, and, like, to Skyrim's strengths.
Yeah, and not make the main quest stuff feel really overbearing. Because I also think that in some ways that is what The Witcher did. Because The Witcher has Velen, Novigrad, and the Skellige Isles, areas which, like, while there is a leveling element to, like, the most sort of, like, ideal order of tackling those places, you can go wherever you want. It's like, go find Ciri is really your objective, and then finding out all the stories of all these different places and sort of connecting the pieces is the real story of The Witcher 3, and I feel like that's such a smart way to sort of try to structure the narrative of the narratives of these kinds of games, whether you're a really heavily narrative game like The Witcher 3 or really light on narrative like Zelda.
Sure, because it really frees you to do to take this game in whatever mode you want while also feeling what you're doing has weight and substance, because whatever you do in the game ultimately ties back into Ganon just by virtue of what that quest marker is.
Yeah.
That whatever you do will help you in that final fight, will help you get to that point. And it gives you, it's a way to have utter directionlessness that feels directed, and I like that about the game.
Yeah.
So,
and it is exactly what an open world game, like, by its very definition, needs, and, like, it's something that I really, really hope, because obviously open world games are not going away anytime soon, that these other games sort of pay attention to that. Like, that's something that I think Horizon Zero Dawn has a little bit of that, but I think if it had done that more, it would have been a better game for it. Even as much as I like that story, I think there are ways to sort of have handled the different tribes and stuff like that in a more, like, the way Zelda does it, that would have worked for the plot better.
And, you know, honestly, it's easy to draw the lines with Breath of the Wild to a Skyrim, to Witcher, and some of these other things, influences like, obviously, other Zelda games, Ocarina of Time. But one game I keep coming back to thinking is also Mario 64. Of a game that, you know, the goal is, I need, and it's tiered goals, but it's like, I need 8 stars to get here, 20 stars to get here. And how you get those stars, which stars you get, that's up to you.
Yeah.
And it's up to what is open to you. And that's obviously, at this point, 21-year-old example and primitive in some ways. But it's a fascinating game structure that I think we're kind of getting back to in some ways.
Yeah. I wish, like, 3D platformers had done that more, because that is by far my favorite thing about Super Mario 64, structure.
It makes me so interested to see what they do with Mario Odyssey.
Yeah.
Given what a creative renaissance they have with this Zelda game and what great creativity they've always had with Mario, what can they do with that kind of structure now in year 2017? That's going to be if they can have a 1-2 punch of a great, a historically great Mario and historically great Zelda in 1 year, that's a hell of a year for Nintendo.
Wouldn't it be amazing if at E3 they like start talking like, and so like you just get this one objective, defeat Bowser, and it's like, and you can go to the like lava world and get do all that stuff, or if you just do this platforming challenge, you can go and you can throw Bowser into three bombs right away.
I mean, it is. That actually even goes back to like Mario World, where you can skip through different levels,
right?
If you
yeah,
do,
like
the star,
zones and stuff, yeah.
You know, so anyway, but we're getting off track again. I don't know. A lot of good things to talk about here.
Yeah.
One of the other things I had on my list that I wanted to mention, and we've mentioned it a little bit, but it comes off over time with cutscenes, is I love the use of silence in this game.
Yeah.
It's something I love so much, which is, and it was thrown into stark relief when I started playing Mass Effect Andromeda, but I love that this game is so minimalist in so much of what it does, in that, you know, your UI on screen, or the HUD, what you actually have on your screen, is pretty minimalistic, even before you use Pro Mode for the HUD. You know, how much sound there is in the world, the soundtrack is very minimalistic, and it comes up when it, you know, wants to come up and needs to come up, and it just punctuates things. And the sound design is really, really good, sound effects and stuff like that, but it's also not, there's not a ton of it. There's enough that you can always parse what is what. And sometimes the world is just quiet, and you're out there in
it. There's not music playing 100% of the time, which I think is important. And, like, the music that is there is very environmental. You know, it's like a lot of piano, just sort of like a handful of notes while you're wandering around. And I think that does a lot to just be like, okay, good. Like, because if there was like big, like blowing, like fanfare Zelda music all the time, in the way that, like, you know, in Ocarina of Time, I love the Hyrule Field main theme to death. If that was playing for the entire time I was playing Legend of Zelda, I would fucking kill myself at some point, because it's like, that's, that kind of music is not meant to be listened to on repeat forever and ever and ever and ever. It's supposed to sort of ferry you to your next junction in this game.
Absolutely. And, you know, so I just, that general quietness to it, that there's also minimal voice acting, and so a lot of what it is you are with the game, and there's not things, sometimes I think voice acting can be a negative thing in game, where I think it pushes against you in some ways when there's wall-to-wall voice acting in a world where maybe you just want to be with it and not hear some of that. And I love that Zelda has that sense of quietness to it. I find it an incredibly relaxing game to play, a calm game to play, and I think it's something that an open world game like this can encourage so inherently. And a lot don't, you know. Grand Theft Auto would be a bad example, but, you know, there's other games have come close to this, I think. Like, Red Dead had a good view on how to do this sometimes.
Yeah.
I think...
Red Dead actually had, a very similar approach to its score, you know? Just, like, every once in a while, it's just like, bow, 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 and like, oh, that was cool.
Yeah. Totally. Like, this is a guitarist to piano with these two games. Yeah. But, like, you know, Skyrim is obviously, I think, one of the grandfathers of this in terms of the Jeremy Soule score and how much that unlocks that game.
Yeah.
Even though I think there are sometimes other things in that game that work against it, like where I think sometimes there can be too many dragons or enemies coming at you in Skyrim.
I think for me the biggest issue with Skyrim, and this is true of several open world games, I think Zelda is very smart in how it handles its battle music, because the battle music is, like, it's distinctively battle music, but it's still very subtle, and, like, it comes up subtly, whereas, like, a game like Skyrim, there is just sometimes where you're wandering around the world, and then all of a sudden, the battle music starts playing, and you're like, is there, like, a wolf somewhere that I got pissed off or something? Like, why is this music playing, and, like, the battle music is so intense because it's battle music, but there's nothing really intense going on. I think Zelda's smart in that, like, the battle music is still good, and it sounds like Zelda battle music, but it's not like, ba 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 or something like that, you know?
Absolutely, and it's also the way music comes in, which is worth talking about, that so much of the game is tied to different music signifiers, that, like, you might not know you're near a horse stable, but you know the horse stable theme, and the closer you get, it comes up on the soundtrack, but it doesn't just come in. Most games, music just comes in, right?
Yeah.
This game, it'll start really soft, and the closer you get, it'll fade up until you're there, and then it's just the soundtrack. And they do that with battles, they do that with places, they do that with certain characters in the game, and it's a great, smart way of both not overwhelming you and also giving you necessary information.
Yeah.
Like, it's something really fascinating about this game, the more you kind of look at it and study it, is how many environmental cues the game is giving you, and how much you learn to read those things like a second language. And it's not having to tell you those things. You know, something I love about that. And when I, you know, picked up Mass Effect Andromeda, Not that Mass Effect Andromeda goes too heavy on a lot of these things. It's just, it felt like I was suddenly watching a Michael Bay movie and like an assault on all the senses. And I'm not saying that's necessarily the bad thing about Andromeda, but Andromeda is a more traditional game where it's got the blaring music and it's got gunfire and it's got characters everywhere and stuff like that. And I was just like, man, Zelda might have broken me of my ability to enjoy that, at least for the time being. Yeah, so... or if you're going to do overt stylization like that, you got to do it like Persona and just be that fucking suave.
Exactly, yes.
There you go.
That is like the other... It's like you go onto the far extreme and it's just like, okay, like yes, you came up with a song that I could literally listen to for the rest of my life and I wouldn't mind.
It is. It's all about execution, right?
Yes.
Zelda can execute on this where I think other games couldn't, and Persona can execute on that where pretty much no other game can.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's whether you have Shoji Meguro or not, right?
Yes.
No, but all the music in this game, I mean, it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
It's so good, and there's actually more of it than you think. I think the more you play, like you're like, oh, there's actually more of it to this world. Like, I have the soundtrack from the special edition, which they didn't skimp on that for a pack-in soundtrack. It's like a full 80 minutes, and it gives you most of the main stuff, but there's still a lot of music I wish I had a track for that I could go back and listen to. But yeah, it's very beautiful. It's very judicious in using actual, like, Zelda music, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't even want to spoil where some of it comes in, because it's kind of fascinating, the moments where you think you might hear it, and it doesn't, and it's never too forceful in that way. And you don't usually see that kind of restraint with games with long-running, you know, musical things, you know?
Yeah. Like, you saying that just, like, made me think about, like, you know, fuck, like, the Hyrule Field theme from Ocarina of Time. Can you imagine if, like, the main main Zelda theme from, like, The Legend of Zelda played, like, the overall theme, the entire game? Like, you're playing this game for, like, 100 hours, and, like, that would be, because the nature of the game is so, like, you're just in the overworld for, like, 90% of your time playing this game, it would be mind-numbing. It would kill you inside.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, it's also something I've thought about. You know, you'd mentioned, you've talked about several times on this podcast about how some games have so much visual information, it's become this trope to have detective vision or something.
Yeah.
To see things. I often feel like one of the reasons I think I often play games with the volume down and listening to a podcast is because I have to do that for myself sometimes if I'm just doing a menial activity or something in a game and I need to shut out parts of the games like sonic design or something and just kind of focus in. I almost never put on anything else while I'm playing Zelda, even though I've done a lot, and there are times when I'm collecting or something. Very rarely, unless I was like, I came into the room listening to a podcast and I wanted to hear the last 5 minutes or something, because Zelda is so judicious in when it does and doesn't use sound, I'm often just with it, and I don't ever want to break away from that.
I will say, earlier today when I was upgrading all of my armor that I hadn't upgraded yet, I put on a podcast.
Sure, because... sure.
Like, that is one of the things of, like, I think there's a lot of small usability things they could have done with the UI in different places. Like, with the cooking. At least, like, with the cooking, I think there's a legitimate argument, even if it frustrated me, like, of that, like, of taking your time with it, because I think there's something physical about the way they handle cooking.
And I like that, but yeah. I understand where you're coming from. I just like it, yeah.
I think, like, they could have maybe tweaked the cooking system in such a way that, like, you didn't feel compelled to do, like, to cook a lot of stuff. Or, like, to have so much stuff on hand that it feels wasteful not to be able to cook. But, like, there's some stuff, like, the way that you have to go into your menu to drop shields and bows and stuff like that. It, like, chests just closing. Like, I just did the Zora thing, and after the end of the Zora thing, they give you that spear. Mm-hmm. And I had full weapons. It was so fucking... Because I hadn't really thought about it, that I hadn't broken a weapon defeating that boss. And so I went up to the chest and opened the chest. And it's like, here's, like, the magical mega spear of the Zora species. The, like, trident hand-forged by the ancient king. Your weapons are full. And the chest just closes on you. You're like, well... Like, I'll put this fucking, like, twig or whatever in the chest instead. Like, just, like, let me, in this menu, drop that kind of stuff.
It would be nice if it just said, would you like to swap, and then go in, and, like, you would drop your twig and your thing would be in. It would be really a nice little thing. It by no means ruins the game, but it's a...
But it's like, but you run into it often enough that it just becomes a little bit obnoxious. Especially, it's worse for shields and bows because you can't drop those in quick ways. Because with a weapon, you can just chuck it.
Yeah.
With a shield or a bow, you have to literally, like, go into your menu, tab through, like, your 5 pages of apples you have, and then drop your shield. It's like they're nitpick things, but there is like little stuff like that. That, or for me, probably like the most significant nitpick I have is I don't know who at Nintendo decided there was going to be a good idea to put the run and jump buttons at the opposite top and bottom of the diamond. or yeah, the sprint and jump buttons, that it's like so fucking stupid. And you can swap which ones they are, but that doesn't really solve the issue, because for me, like, what you want to be able to sprint and jump at the, like, at the same time, like, whether or not the game even really asks that of you, because it doesn't often, like, you just want to be able to do that as an action in the world. At least I want to, like, that's how I played a lot of video games in my life, is sprinting and jumping at the same time between point A to point B. And there's a lot of getting between point A and point B in Zelda, and I want to sprint and jump at the same time. And the only for me the only comfortable way to do that is by having sprint beyond the top button and jump beyond the bottom button, because you can press down on the top button, roll your thumb down on the bottom one, and that's, like, that's fine. The problem is, when you do that, it doesn't swap the cancel button in the menu. And so all of a sudden, every time you're dealing with menus, the bottom button is cancel. When you're dealing with stuff in the open world, the top button is cancel. And I cannot tell you how many fucking times I have gotten that mixed up in the middle of combat and wanted to, like, put a bomb away or something, and kept on ending up jumping because I'm pressing B, and it's like, well, no, you have to hit the sprint button to cancel whatever action you're doing in the open world. Like, that's... And there's a couple of other little control things like that, like, be like when you do magnesis... It's really weird to me that when you're picking something up with magnesis, you can't hit like L1 or whatever to just drop it in the way that you can with like all your other powers, cancel out of your powers just by hitting L1 again. You have to hit the cancel button for it to drop, which is the top button for like my control setup. And so it's like little things like that that just feel like kind of like very un-Nintendo, because Nintendo usually is very, very smart about how they do that stuff. And here it feels like maybe because... You know, Nintendo has not traditionally done a game like this, and this kind of game demands like a more complicated control setup. They've maybe made some weird missteps of like, just have sprint be like pushing on the left stick. Like, it's fine. Like, every game has done that. It works well. It would have made things a lot easier if you had just decided to do that.
Here's the thing. So I've heard this complaint from others, definitely. Yeah. It's like probably the most common nitpick people have is some of those button placements.
Yeah.
Doesn't bother me at all. I haven't done the switch of the buttons, so I actually didn't see that before.
It took me such a long time to figure out that was why that was happening. It took me like 6 hours of playing the game, and then I realized, oh, right, at the very beginning I switched this because I tried both methods and found that to be the most comfortable,
yeah.
And now I can't go back.
I do think it should be an option, is all I'm saying, to reconfigure some of those controls, because controls are a weird thing, and there should always be more options, not less, with controls. Personally, I'm actually not someone who likes like holding like the sprint thing on
those
sticks.
Don't hold it. Just like have it be a toggle.
Even some of that I don't like. Just it's a weird thing with games. I actually like just holding the button and doing it, but especially because of the way it does the way that depletes your stamina. There's just something like kinesthetic about it to me, where it like makes more sense of holding it and then I unhold it and it does that. I always, in a weird way, have problems with games where, unless it's like just a normal FPS where you're running and then you stop running and things like that, it's weird to me and I don't like it. But that's not me saying that should be the way for everyone else. That's why options are nice.
Yeah.
And, you know, mini games could use more control options. This is something they could easily patch in if they wanted to.
Yeah.
So...
And then also, like, thinking of that reminds me, have you, like, really done much with the stealth stuff in this game? Because,
mm-hmm.
like, I just have never found it to be particularly useful. And, like, part of it is, like, that, like, clicking in the left stick being taken up by the crouch button and me, like, never really using it has made me weirdly vindictive about the stealth system in the game. Because, like, if that was just sprint, all my problems would have been fixed with this. Well, not all my problems, but, like, that, this, like overriding nitpick that just annoys me a lot would be fixed. And I just like find like the stealth system is like just feels kind of superfluous to me. I don't know, like I could like there are a couple of instances.
It's definitely not
where
superfluous.
Cool.
There are scenarios where you need
okay,
it.
Yeah. Like I don't know if there's like other things more specific. Because there's like a couple of spots with like the elephant dudes where it's kind of cool that you can do cool stuff with that. But in general, I feel like it kind of felt like one system too many, especially like with like having stealth potions and like stealth clothing and stuff like that. Again, there could very well be like other dungeon stuff that makes it easier.
You need it for horses. You need it for another.
Yeah, I've caught several horses by. Actually, I don't even think I have ever caught a horse using stealth. I've always just dropped on them from above.
Well, okay, that's
yeah. Yeah. I mean,
just because you did it that way.
Yeah, but I'm saying like there could be other systems you could use to get horses that are not the stealth system.
Sure, there are other mounts you get later in parts you haven't been to that need stealth. And there are scenarios where I think you can sneak up on enemies and get some cool things you can do. Like, there are some Makoblin encampments where, like, with their bomb setups, if you're stealthy enough, you can just take them all out at once and things like that. Hinoxes, if you're stealthy enough, you can steal their stuff without having to fight them at all. There are some scenarios, specifically some like following things that require stealth. So yeah, and there are also some things you can get, like the Sheikah armor and stuff.
Yeah, I bought that stealth. And then listened to a podcast while I had it all upgraded, while I thumbed through fucking like a dozen dialogue boxes. That lady trying to talk to me is like, I get it. This is like the seventh piece of armor I've upgraded, lady.
The Great Fairy, you're talking
about? Yes, the Great Fairy. Like, let's keep this train moving.
Yeah. All right. The Great Fairies. I love that they have kept up the cycle of the Great Fairies just becoming weirder with every Zelda game.
Yeah, and like sexualized in ways that make you weirdly uncomfortable.
But like, knowingly, like,
yes, no, definitely, like, yes, yeah. They're aware of what they're doing, but it's still like, it is impressive that they have continued that trend and gotten more extreme with it with each game, it's felt like.
Yeah, it's very funny, but, yeah, so, we did not intend for tonight's podcast to be 3 hours.
No, but, you know.
We've talked a lot, I mean,
I've been able to talk about Zelda.
So. To me, this is a sign of what an amazing game this is, yeah. Is that it gives you, so, I mean, we're not even scratching through the surface on a lot of this stuff. There's so many other things we could talk about. Including just, I'm curious about what experiences you've had in different places and stuff. Or like, you know, one of my favorite moments in the game is one you mentioned of climbing Mount Lanayru and finding that shrine and finding that dragon and the music that plays and saving that dragon. And then it kind of, you get these rewards for it. It was a beautiful, beautiful sequence.
Yeah.
Just, and beautiful in a way that I've never seen another game approach that kind of beauty, because it's not built in the same way, and it's not, doesn't have that kind of silence, and those moments don't come up on you as subtly. Like, there's so much subtlety in this game that I love in its beauty and its splendor and its wonder. And I love that about it. So
I love that apparently, based on that item description, I could have just taken that scale and gone and like made like a stake out of it or something instead of getting my shrine orb. And I'm really curious what happens if you do that. It's like, is that shrine orb just forever?
You can get more scales.
Okay, from him specifically? Yes. Okay, yeah, I haven't seen him again.
Yeah, you will. There's more you can do with the dragons, but they're... I love all the dragons. They're cool.
Can I kill the dragons and make dragon steak?
No.
Can I just throw bombs? I love...
Here's how deep my connection to this game runs. I had a moment recently where I had killed some animals for their meat, but at one point there was this... I never killed the wolves because they look too much like dogs, and I love dogs. And usually the wolves were totally nice to me. And one day, one of the wolves kind of, I guess I got too close and it attacked me. And I instinctively pulled out my weapon, which I think was a meteor rod. And I burned him and two of his friends to death. And then there was one wolf left and it ran off. And I felt so bad for that one wolf that no longer had its family that I have literally not killed a single animal since.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that you like reverted to your Red Dead Redemption ways and just like hunted it down and like sacrificed it or something to like make amends to the wolf gods.
I have some meat that I have gotten from other sources. I will not kill an animal in this game. I have become a... I am adopting a Shinto philosophy to the world in this game, and I will not eat of the flesh of an animal.
See, what I love about that is, for me, I almost went the opposite way. But I feel like the game sort of incentivized me, because you just can throw bombs constantly. And then I upgraded my bombs, so I can throw bombs even more constantly, and they do fucking 24 points of damage. And so not only am I just killing everything I run into, but because I don't want to use up arrows, or like all my weapons have like durability on them, I don't, like, it's a waste to use them. I'm not just killing goats or like squirrels and shit. I'm literally throwing bombs at them and blowing them up. And like, it, obviously it's a very cartoony way, but it is, when you think about it, I'm killing them in like the most brutal fucking like violent way possible. And it's the bombs, I think, are a really interesting addition to the game that I feel like maybe they could have balanced them in a slightly different way, because they feel like you can use those things to really cheese your way through a lot of encounters in the game.
Sure,
especially
yeah.
Early on, which, like, and it feels like because of the weapon durability system, you're, like, sort of implicitly incentivized to find ways to solve combat encounters without using your weapons. And the number one way to do that is to just blow those fuckers up with a big fucking bomb. It's like, maybe they could have limited how much you use them, limited how much damage they do or something, but you just fight. I just blow fuckers up all the time. It's ridiculous. I went... Because the first thing I did after I upgraded my bomb was to go to the Zora domain, or like more to the point, the day before I started the Zora stuff, was the last thing I had done was upgrade all of my Sheikah stuff, because I had finally killed Guardians and gotten a bunch of their like good, juicy mechanical innards and turned that into bomb stuff. And so after I got all my good bomb stuff, I went to the Zora domain and I went through that entire area, and you know there's like this whole like the bunch of little Lizalfos camps and everything. I killed all those fuckers without using a single goddamn weapon. I just blew them all to fucking hell. And it felt so
good. I guess I didn't think that way.
It felt so good.
One other thing I want to say about this game that I think is also something I've realized is part of why I enjoy it is because of the Nintendo Switch of it for me. I've had a crazy, hectic, busy schedule the last 2 weeks, and so I've brought my Switch with me to a lot of places, and this game is surprisingly great for like 20-minute sittings or 10-minute sittings.
I definitely see that.
And just like part of why I actually enjoy the cooking system so much is sometimes it's fun to just, if I have 10 minutes with the game, it's fun to just kind of cook for 10 minutes and just see what happens with it and put the ingredients together and get ready for whatever I'm going to do next. Or
you just get 5 defense things and put 5 defense things in there because that gets you the best shit. God damn it.
And it really, it really is, I think, just such a perfect launch game for the Switch because of that reason, because it totally exemplifies a game of that you would want at home and you want on the go. It's perfect for that. So it's great. And I actually I have 6 games on my Switch right now.
Jeez.
One of them is free, which they've put up the Splatoon 2 Global Test Fire, and you can download it now. The beta is next week.
Oh, okay.
So I'll play some of that. There's like the multiplayer beta test, so I'll try that. So that's not a permanent thing. I've got some other ones, and a lot of them I'm kind of waiting to play until I'm done with Zelda. At this rate, because I've spent more time with Zelda than I thought I would, I might not have time between Zelda and Persona, but Persona I can't take with me, so I'll have those for other scenarios. So
yeah.
It's too bad Vita Remote Play will not work outside my house. It's the thing, but it's all good. So good time for video games. That's Zelda.
Yeah,
we'll be back.
Talk about that some more. Like, well, maybe we won't like do too much until we both finish the game.
I think that's probably a good idea. Although, judging by, I mean, we have not clickbaited this nearly as much as most gaming websites.
No.
So,
like, there was like a good long, there was basically 2 weeks there where I couldn't listen to any gaming podcasts or anything because it's just like I can't listen to that much talk about a video game I have not played a single second of. So now I have a bunch of podcasts I could go listen to that are all backed up.
Nice. Yeah, it's weird. I actually, I don't generally listen to gaming podcasts or movie podcasts because we do this, and so I just can't do it. I did listen to a little bit of Kotaku's podcast recently because I wanted to hear their specific thoughts on Andromeda and make sure I wasn't crazy on this. And they're not as down on it as I am, but I'm not alone. So.
Yeah, the Waypoint Radio podcast episode from Monday has some good talk about Mass Effect Andromeda, and more specifically, some good talk about Mass Effect 1. Mass Effect 1 is a very good game.
It's a very good game. It's 10 years old this year.
Yes, I think there's something. Maybe this will be our closing discussion to get away from Zelda. Back a little bit to Mass Effect. Why is there not a collection of Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3 on the PS4 and Xbox One? Because I really want to play those games again, and I don't want to plug in my Xbox 360 again.
I know. Xbox One does have, they're all on backwards compatibility.
Okay.
So that's nice. Like, it's not the same as having a full remaster, but if you have your discs, you can play them on your Xbox One to your heart's content, which is great. Why there's not a remaster, like, that's just money on the table. Like, that's just so stupid. Like,
it's just so perfect for it because of how you can just bring your character through all three of the games, and I've had this urge for a while now, but everyone talking about Mass Effect Andromeda and listening to, like, talk about the Mass Effect trilogy in comparison and realizing how old those games are now. Because, again, Mass Effect 3 came out when we were freshmen in college. It's like, we are both college graduates, and we have been for a little bit now.
Yeah.
So, it's like, it's been a while, and I really want to play through those games again because I just had this realization of, like, oh, right, the Mass Effect trilogy is one of my favorite video game things ever. I really should play through those games again.
It's pretty much the only series of its stature that has not had that remaster.
Yeah.
At least from that, 360 PS3 era. And it is strange because, as you say, it would be perfect, get them all on a disc, get all the DLC together, because even as big of fans of Mass Effect as we are, there was so much DLC for those games. We have not played all of it, especially for 3. And, EA pulled so much of their bullshit in cutting things out of the game and stuff. Just make complete editions, have it all on one Blu-ray disc or something, and be able to play Mass Effect. That would be wonderful. Everyone would love it. No one would accuse them of a cash grab, even though that's what it would be. But that'd be a great cash. We're all asking for it.
Yeah.
I want that more than I want most of those other remasters.
I want that more than I want Mass Effect Andromeda at this point, based on all the pre-release discussion.
Seriously, like, my main thing with Andromeda, like, well, one, I wanted to go back to playing Zelda because I'm currently playing it, but it also just made me want to play Mass Effect 1, 2, 3. Because I'm like, I could play such a better version of this. And, I also think those games just deserve it, to have, like, that archive for the new generation and everything. And, of course, as with lots of those, there's probably a lot of people who didn't get to play those. So it'd be a perfect thing. I don't know if BioWare thinks, like, they're too busy. They can farm it out if they want. No one does these in-house, generally. Naughty Dog kind of did with Last of Us, but not with Uncharted.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Like, just fucking find someone, do it. We all want it. And we'll forgive you for Andromeda, maybe.
Yeah, it's just, it feels weird that there was a good couple of years there when these consoles were new where it felt like I was kind of like, like these remastered things are just ridiculous. Nobody wants these. And there are some of those of like the remastered Infamous, or not Infamous, Prototype 1 and 2 HD remasters on the PlayStation 4. Who the fuck asked for those to be on this console? And here I am now, and I really desperately want that.
Because I think we all assumed it was coming.
Yeah.
Like, take it for granted. Like, once we've had all the BioShocks, the Arkham games, all of Uncharted,
every single Halo game is playable on Xbox One.
Every single Halo game. What's the silliest one I was thinking of? The Ezio trilogy for Assassin's Creed. How do we have that before Mass Effect? I mean, come on, BioWare. That's money on the table.
Yeah.
You're leaving. Because, hey, I don't think Andromeda is going to do spectacularly if those reviews hold.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, those reviews are coming out tomorrow. I'm fascinated. It's another skeezy thing that some companies are doing that I don't like. This game is out in the wild. You can play. I mean, it's a 10-hour trial, but it's the game. And people aren't allowed to post their reviews until tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's just stupid. I'm sorry. That's just... And the game was gold weeks ago. They could have had it out for reviewers. And the review embargo should have been the day it went live to the public.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it.
You know, hey, at least they're not doing the Bethesda thing of, like, Bethesda's just like, we'll give you this game the day it comes out and run your reviews whenever you want.
But frankly, that's at least a principled position, which is just we don't send it to reviewers.
Sure.
And that's, to me, that's completely their prerogative. But to the opposite of, like, we'll send it out, but you don't get to review it. Everyone else who's playing these 10 hours can talk about it. You don't get to review it until Monday. It's bizarre. It's the game's... It's like when Assassin's Creed Unity had its embargo after the game was out.
Exactly.
It's kind of the same thing. Anyway, that's our podcast for this week. We've got a lot more coming up. Crazy times.
Yes. I have to go back to play more Zelda, and the ever-looming tempest of Persona 5 is on the horizon to consume this podcast in its inevitable apotheosis.